Okay. So welcome, everyone, to the March 27, 2019, 9/11 and Other Deep State Crimes teleconference. And let's start, Craig, with the roll call.
Sure. I have, so far, Craig McKee, Cheryl Curtis, Marty Hopper, David Cole, Xander Arena, Jason Burmes, Barbara Honegger, Mike Cook, Pat O'Connell, Greg Flynn, Ann Hendricks, Miko Paled, Charles Ewing Smith, Kat McGuire, Roger Boris, Frank Chalopko, Marie Spike, Peter Ketchum, Ken Freeland, and Bonnie Faulkner. Did I miss anybody?
Yes, you missed me, Sherry Jackson.
Oh, okay, didn't know you were there. Okay, and I don't think I got you either, Dave Meiswinkle. I think I missed you too.
Right, you did.
Yeah, let me get that on there.
What an awesome array.
John O'Malley.
Oh, okay.
Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, John.
Hi, Don.
Hi.
So I think I've added those on there, so I think we're good, Cheryl.
Okay, great. Are there any, looking at the minutes for February's meeting, are there any amendments or changes to that that anyone would like to propose?
Yeah, this is Ken Freeland. I'd like to move to amend the minutes.
Okay.
The second paragraph, the second sentence. So subsequently, Sheila was removed from the call. I'm proposing to strike the word subsequently and replace it with, after she openly refused to accept this limitation of her discourse, comma, then it would read Sheila was removed from the call.
Does anyone want to second that? I don't know. Do we have to second that?
Well, you could
Yes, there'd have to be a second.
Yeah. Does anyone want to second that?
I'll second.
Okay. Cool. Any discussion on this?
Well, Cheryl, you should ask if there are objections, because if there aren't, then normally we just accept it. If there are, then we have to go into debate, but otherwise
okay.
We can move forward.
Are there any objections?
Yeah. I object, Barbara.
Yeah, Craig, I object as well.
Okay, now back to the debate mode.
Okay, so who would like to say something?
Well, since I made the motion, I get the floor first, okay?
All right, go ahead, Ken.
Thank you. Okay, well, the way it's stated right here, it's not clear why Sheila was removed, and I believe that has to be stated for the record because the subsequent activity is also hinging on the purpose for which she was taken off the call. So I think anybody that goes back and listens to the call will hear very clearly that I did ask her if she understood that she was not allowed to use the call for that purpose, and she said she did not. She did not accept that understanding. So that is the reason she was taken off the call, and it needs to be part of the record, okay? That's all I have to say.
Barbara, I have a comment.
Okay, Barb, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm against this motion, I guess it is, because there are a number of us anyway, including myself, who feel that in this particular instance, and I think Ken does a great job usually, but I think that he really overstepped his authority to remove her from the call unilaterally. I object.
Okay, anyone else?
Yeah, Craig.
Okay, Craig, go ahead.
I don't think the question to Sheila at the time was put quite as clearly as it just was now by Ken. I think this was a confrontation where Ken was, I think at that point, was provoking Sheila by saying, do you understand, yes or no? I believe those were his exact words. And that was not just a question. That was kind of poking her to respond emotionally, I think unnecessarily. So I mean, in terms of the wording that Ken has proposed, I would definitely say that would not be fair.
Anyone else? Okay.
I would like to chime in that I thought that Ken was very clear about the situation and that the meeting was getting way out of control and he tried his best.
And who's speaking?
Roger.
Roger. Okay.
But yeah, that's not the what we're discussing.
Out of order. Point of order.
Okay, Ken, go ahead.
Well, Craig was out of order. He has no business interrupting anybody else when they're speaking.
Okay, so I'm gonna jump in here and just say I think that these are just the summary of the minutes. I think that this captures it in a summary form.
Objection.
Without getting into
point
more
of detail. Point of order.
Go ahead.
The chair is clearly partial in the matter. The chair should not be conducting this particular part of the session because the chair has already registered an opinion against my motion.
I think I have a right to give my opinion.
You do not. No, I'm sorry. Well, okay, fine. I can see where this is all going to go eventually, but you're wrong. So we'll just let it go. I'm not going to pursue it.
So you're dropping it.
I'm dropping
it. Okay.
Good.
Okay. Great. So then, hearing no other objections, then the minutes have been approved, and we'll move on now.
There's a motion to approve to amend the minutes. Where are you going?
You said you dropped it.
Ken, why don't you calm down?
Why don't you shut up? Craig, you keep interrupting other people. You have no right to do that.
You're interrupting her.
Okay, all right. I'm going to ask that we hold this discussion at the end of the call so that our speakers
don't have to
sit and listen to
objection.
This.
Objection.
And then we can come back to it later.
I object to moving this question. The question is right now to approve the minutes or not. There's an amendment on the floor to approve the minutes. Unless you take a vote and everybody wants to do this, I believe it's out of order. We should just take a vote on this. That's all that needs to happen, and then we can move forward.
And I'm recommending that we move it to the end of the call so that we can get our speakers. Is there anyone else who seconds that motion?
I second it.
Okay. Opposed.
Okay.
That's a debatable motion.
What's that?
It's a debatable motion.
All right. So does anyone want to say anything, or do we take a vote whether we move on and put this to the end of the call?
I would like to say something.
Well, I have limited time.
This is Ken Freeland. I would like to speak to the motion.
Go ahead, Ken.
I cannot stay till the end of the call, so I need to be able to handle this now or else have it postponed until next week.
Well, then let's postpone it until next
week. Then let's postpone it.
We have three speakers, and we want to get to them.
Fair enough. I won't object to postponing it until next week, but I can't stay till the end of the call.
Okay. All right. So it's agreed then that we are postponing it till next month. Okay. Great. Okay. So and then the moving on then. So the minutes have been postponed until next month for approval or discussion of that of Ken's motion. And then the agenda for tonight. Are there any amendments or motions for that? Any amendments, changes?
Well, except that I'm here as well for the.
Okay, we'll add that in. Yeah. Okay, great. So let's get started then with our speakers. The agenda is approved with the addition of Barbara's name. And let's see. So we're going to start with our speaker, Miko. Thank you for joining us. And Sherry Aspen is going to introduce Miko. Sherry?
Okay, hello, everybody. This is Sherry here in San Diego. And I am very honored to introduce Miko Pile. Miko shares our mission of truth and peace. And I just came from a group of 40 kids at the YMCA where I'm on staff helping out. And I want us all to take a moment to remember the children of the world, because that's really what makes me know that I'm doing the right thing when I be with those kids. You know, they don't have any idea what they've gotten into just by being alive. And those kids that have those benefits where I was at the Y, all kids should have that, you know. So anyway, one of the things I wanted to say is that Miko and I share friends. Nalise and Ted Muga here, the founders of San Diego 9/11 Truth, happen to be friends of Miko. And that's how I got involved in our mission, is through San Diego 9/11 Truth. And now I'm really good friends with Nalise, who's very active with Jewish Sports for Peace right now, and I attend their meetings as well. And I wanted to let you know, Miko, that Nalise sends her love. She told me that the first time Miko met a Palestinian was here in California. I can't tell the story nearly as well as Nalise did, I'm sure you know. But she said that Miko was a little hesitant to meet a Palestinian at first. Growing up in Israel, he never met a Palestinian until he moved to San Diego, as Nalise told me this story. And he met this man named Nasser Barghouti. And I understand that Miko and Nasser are now lifelong friends and work for peace and justice in Palestine. Miko has written many articles about the actual truth about Israel and Palestine, the likes of which are difficult for Americans to even begin to grasp. The nightly media propaganda keeps our fellow citizens in the dark about what they are funding with their hard-earned taxes. Miko is the son of a famous Israeli general and so has lived both sides of the story. He is the author of at least two books, The General's Son, The Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5, which I hope he will tell us more about on our call. This is just a brief introduction, and you can find his article on his website at mikopile.com. So, without further ado, I welcome you, Miko, to our call.
And Miko, if you could just hold on 1 second, I'm going to mute everyone else. And then I'm going to unmute you, so just hang on a second. Okay, so you're unmuted, Miko. Go ahead, thank you.
Okay, and how much time do you want me to speak?
About 20 minutes.
Okay. All right.
And then we'll do a 10-minute Q&A.
Okay, sounds fine. Well, thank you for letting me speak to you all. And thank you for your interest in Palestine. I'll briefly tell you my story and how it relates to Palestine, and then we'll talk about Palestine itself. The first book I wrote is called The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. It came out in 2012, published by Just World Books, and came out in second edition in 2016. And just like the title of the book suggests, I'm the son of an Israeli general. He's quite well known. He was one of the generals of the 1967 war, and he was a young officer in the 1948 campaign, after which Palestine became Israel. And I was raised in a very patriotic Zionist. I had a very patriotic Zionist upbringing. I have in my family a signer of the Declaration of Independence, a president of the State of Israel, cabinet members, members of the parliament, judges, and so on. So it's a family that has contributed a great deal to the creation of the State of Israel, to its military, and on and on. The experience that I had growing up, of course, as a son of a general and a son within a family like that was very positive, a great deal of pride in what we did and what Israel accomplished and so forth. We meaning the Jews who returned to the land of Israel. And the way my perspective changed, and I think that is usually the way perspectives change, certainly think, you know, perspective, I mean like real life perspective, the way we view the world and, you know, things that cause us to really reflect deeply is typically as a result of a tragedy, something shocking, something that forces us out of our comfort zone and into, you know, a deeper and clearer look at the world. In my case, it was in 1997 when my sister's little girl was killed in a suicide mission in Jerusalem. And certainly that's the kind of thing that will shock you to a point where you have to start looking at the world in a deeper way. A 13-year-old girl being killed so brutally, three young men killing themselves in the process, others were killed as well and injured. This is not something we are capable, I think, of understanding at all, much less accepting. And through a process that took several years, I began to engage my sense was that I need to begin to engage deeply in this issue. Now, I was living in America for 20 years. I was not engaged in this issue at all. I mean, I cared about it, but I had my career in martial arts. I had a happy life in San Diego, and everything was fine. And basically what this did was it forced me, like I said, to start looking, to start searching for someone to talk to. And having grown up in Jerusalem, I never encountered Palestinians. I never met Palestinians. I never saw Palestinians in my home. I've never been to a Palestinian home. I never engaged in a social way or any other way with Palestinians. I mean, we see Palestinians in Palestinian neighborhoods, but we have nothing to do with them. They have nothing to do with us. Jerusalem is a completely segregated city. And this is when I grew up there, there were no walls or checkpoints. It was just segregated because it was segregated. And we knew, as every privileged colonial society knows, that the other is dangerous and we must not cross the boundaries that separate our sphere and our neighborhoods from theirs. And so we never did. And so we never met or encountered Palestinians. And having taken that step, I mean, I took a step, like you heard earlier, it was actually in San Diego the first time I met the Palestinians. It wasn't Nasser Barghouti, it was George Khoury. George Majid Khoury was his home. And there was a dialogue group in San Diego, and I began to attend, and that was the first time I ever met Palestinians. It was, you know, not in Jerusalem, not in Palestine, but in San Diego. And the people that I met in that group allowed me to take this journey, because the subtitle of the book is Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. To take that journey and to suddenly gain an understanding, not suddenly actually, but gradually gain an understanding, what does it mean? What is Israel? What's an Israeli? And what is Palestine? And where do the two meet? And how are they different? And that journey was basically, like I said earlier, the journey from the sphere of the privileged colonizer where there's plenty of water and the roads are paved and it's very safe and it's very nice and green, to the sphere where the roads are full of potholes and there are no parks and everything is kind of dusty and a little bit dirty and neglected, and to understand why is it like that. How come they look so dusty and dirty, and why do they have potholes? The assumption I always had, and the assumption people still have when they're you know, traveling throughout the country, is that the Jews are developed and sophisticated and educated, and the Arabs are just backwards, and that's why they live the way they do. When you take the journey, as I did, you realize that they're not backward, we're not sophisticated, but they live under a completely different set of laws, a completely different reality. You learn that the Israeli Water Authority, which controls all the water in the country, allocates only 3% of the water to the Palestinian population. Now, Palestinians make up more than half of the population. But if you drive along the highways and you drive, you'll see on one side of the highway, you'll see a Palestinian town. Across the highway, you'll see Israeli towns. And you'll notice that all the Palestinian homes have these enormous black water tanks on their roofs because they need to store water because their water supply is limited to certain hours of the day, certain hours of the week. Sometimes a Palestinian town will have 10 or 12 hours of running water per week, when across the street, the Israeli town has unlimited water. So obviously the priorities are different. So obviously the backyard is going to look different. The trees are going to look different. The roads are going to look different. And this is just one example of the differences between the two sides. But you don't know this growing up because, as an Israeli, because you never venture to the other side because the others are dirty and dangerous and irrational and uneducated. And all the things that were said about blacks and about anybody else who was the other in colonial situations, where settler colonialism took hold. And that is the process that is the journey that I began way back then in San Diego, some 20 years ago. And it goes on to this day, and that's what shaped my view on Palestine. And that's what my view on how the Palestinian issue can be resolved, and my understanding of what the reality in Palestine is and why it is. And when I say Palestine, I mean the entire country. I think it's wrong to call that country Israel, because that negates my values. And the way what I invite people to do is to look deep, reflect on their values, and that is how they should decide, or people should decide, whether they call the country Palestine or Israel. The country was Palestine until May 15th, 1948, and then suddenly overnight it became Israel. And the process that made Palestine into Israel was a process of a cruel campaign of ethnic cleansing and massive, incredible amounts of massacre, violently terrorized, an entire population violently terrorized by Jewish Israeli militias, Zionist militias. And that was a process that was very intense throughout 1948, but didn't ever stop. It goes on even today as we speak. So if we're willing to legitimize that kind of a process, if we're willing to legitimize genocide and ethnic cleansing, if we're willing to legitimize the apartheid regime that took hold in Palestine and has been governing Palestine for the last 7 decades, it's an apartheid regime that offers me all the privileges and the life in a democratic society, but does not allow these privileges, does not provide these privileges to the Palestinians. Anyone who believes that that is, you know, congruent with their values can call the place Israel. If we reject violence and racism, then we should call the country by the name that the native indigenous people call it, which is Palestine. And it's all Palestine, from the River Jordan to the Mediterranean Sea, from Al-Jalil in the north to the Nakab Desert in the south. It's all Palestine. The fact that some people chose to call it Israel, the fact there's a regime that took hold violently, does not mean the name. They get to decide the name of the country. So that's why I choose to call it Palestine. And like I say, I invite people who share my values to do the same. I'll fast forward to 2012, when my book came out, when The General Son came out. I was touring and lecturing. In fact, I began touring and lecturing then. I still do. It hasn't ended all these years later. But I was in Dallas, Texas, and I was approached by a few young activists in one of the universities. And they told me a story that I absolutely could not believe. It was a story of a charity organization called the Holy Land Foundation, which was closed down after 9/11. And 5 Palestinian Americans, Muslims, were tried and convicted, accused of terrorism, then tried and convicted of terrorism, or I should say material support for terrorist organizations, and are now in federal prison serving sentences from 15 to 65 years. So my reaction was disbelief, but I became curious, and thanks to help from some of those activists, I gained access to a great deal of information about the case. And it took me till last year to put together a book, which is called Injustice, the Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5, and it's the story of the 5 men who were wrongfully accused, wrongfully tried, and wrongfully convicted. 5 men who did absolutely nothing wrong. In fact, these are 5 of the finest men I have ever met in my life. But they were Palestinians, or they are Palestinians, they are Muslims. And here in America, to be a Palestinian Muslim in the atmosphere of post-9/11, especially if you're dealing with relief, with charity, is a very, very dangerous proposition. Now, the attempts to discredit the Holy Land Foundation began in the mid-1990s, or early 1990s, actually, mostly by the Anti-Defamation League, which you may have heard of. It's an organization that claims to be a civil rights organization, but it's really an organization that's dedicated to the defamation of Arabs and Palestinians and Muslims in America. And they're behind some of the worst acts of defamation and Islamophobia here in the United States. And they took it upon themselves to discredit this organization, so they began publishing articles or getting articles to be published that the members, the Palestinians who run this organization are from terrorists, that they support terrorism, that they're members of terrorist organizations, and so forth, that their not-for-profit status would be revoked, and so on. After 9/11, the job became a lot easier, and the George Bush, on December the 4th, announced that they are that a major terrorist funding network was closed down. And he was referring to the Hoyland Foundation. Their assets were seized, and they were designated a terrorist organization. And interestingly enough, they weren't concerned because they said, well, America is obviously panicking. It's a big mistake. All our papers are in order. We never did anything wrong. We can prove it. We'll be fine. A civil trial ensued in which the case was thrown out by a judge, and the evidence that the Hoyland Foundation brought to show that they did nothing wrong, in fact, did everything right, was struck from the evidence. And then a criminal case began after followed that, and there were two trials. The second trial ended in 2009, and in fact, this is the 10th year that these men are serving in federal prison. Two of them got 15 years. I'm sorry. The first trial was ended in a mistrial. The jury was hung. And after the second trial, two of them were given 15-year prison sentences, one 20 years, and two of them received 65 years in prison, in federal prison. I visited all but one. For some reason, the authorities didn't allow me to visit one of them. And the entire story of their life, of their story, of the laws that allowed for this to happen, how things evolved, what is Hamas, what is Islam, how they survived, how fine people, normal people who have never committed a crime in their life, much less terrorism, survive in this horrifying, horrifying reality that exists within the walls of federal prison. And all of that is encapsulated in the book. And one of the things that I was particularly grateful to be able to do was to read the court transcripts. I read probably 20,000 pages of court transcripts, which allowed me to see how these two trials were run, or misrun, I should say, mismanaged, and how they managed to get how the government managed to get five good men that did nothing wrong convicted. And I put as much of the court transcripts in the book so people can actually read and see what transpired or what takes place in a courtroom here in the United States. And these guys, the only reason any of this happened is because of what is happening in Palestine. Israel's got a powerful lobby here in the United States. We've got several lobbies, actually. It's got one official lobby. There are lots of groups that support and lobby on behalf and work for the State of Israel, the Jewish Federation, the Defamation League, AIPAC, of course, and others. And they make sure, they're the gatekeepers, and they make sure that the narrative always remains consistent, and that narrative always has to place Israel on the right and the Palestinians on the wrong. And these guys, unbeknownst to them, were doing really good work and gaining a lot of respect, and they were painting a picture that the Israelis and their agency in the United States did not want Americans to see, and that's why they were put in jail. They did nothing wrong. They were not involved in politics. They were certainly not involved in military pursuits or anything like that. And like I said, today they are serving long sentences under very, very difficult conditions. And again, the only reason that they are in prison is because they are Palestinians, because they are Muslims, and because of the relationship between Israel and the United States. And because Israel does not want people to know what is happening, what the true story is, the true story of Palestine. And that is that's very serious. That's very, very serious. Now, I think it's important to state, I mean, I'll kind of fast forward some more to today. I'm sure you, or I'm assuming everybody knows that the Israeli lobby, AIPAC, just had their conference here in Washington, D.C., and that Israeli elections are coming up next month, April 9th. Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the current prime minister, I suspect will continue to be prime minister for a very long time, and every time when he has when he has elections coming up, he stops for a campaign. He comes for a campaign stop here in the United States. In fact, he comes here to campaign and get all these political gifts throughout his tenure as prime minister, and it never fails. So a couple of years ago, he received the United States recognition of Jerusalem as the capital city of Israel, which, according to international law, is an absurdity and politically is completely reckless and misguided. And now he received another gift, which is the United States recognizing that the Golan Heights is a part of Israel. And again, but according to international law, it's absurd, and politically it's reckless, and incredibly irresponsible. And stupid, really, because it's like saying that a part of Italy is actually belongs to France or something like that. I mean, it makes no sense. And looking at the campaign, at the campaigns of the different political parties in Israel, what we see is a mad rush to the right. Every political party tries to prove that they are further to the right of everybody else. And the word right has become this golden, like the gold medal. Whoever is the most right will receive the gold medal. And so everybody criticizes Netanyahu for not killing enough Palestinians, for not bombing Gaza enough. Another political party, which is made of former generals who actually worked under Netanyahu, are, you know, bragging that they did more killing than anybody else of Palestinians. But of course, they did that under orders from Netanyahu, so that's really not their accomplishment. It's Netanyahu's accomplishment. And then all these other small political parties are doing the same thing. Everybody's criticizing everybody else for not being right and on the right, far enough to the right on any issue. What Netanyahu did, he aligned himself with the farthest, most craziest, most right-wing political figures in the Israeli political map. And politically, it makes sense because now nobody can say that they are right of him. And ideologically, it makes sense because he shares their ideology. There's no difference in ideology between any of these political parties. It's certainly not between Netanyahu and these far-right, Nazi-type political parties. And again, politically, it makes sense for him because it shows that he is further right than more further to the right than anybody else. Plus, he's got all these accomplishments. Plus, he's been a very successful prime minister for 10 years and so on and so on. So I think we can expect that he will continue to be prime minister. And much of it is thanks to the Trump administration. So that's where things stand. In terms of what a solution might look like, what a political solution might look like, there's only, I believe, one logical resolution to the question of Palestine, and that is the complete dismantlement of the apartheid regime, just as was done in South Africa when the apartheid regime collapsed, was dismantled, and a democracy with equal rights, full equal rights, took its place. And the actual materializing of the right of the Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and their land today. There's some 5.5 million Palestinian refugees, many of them living in squalor in refugee camps because Israel won't allow them to return to their homes and their land. And on this issue, over the last year, we saw in Gaza these marches, the March of Return protest in Gaza every Friday for the last year. You know, the majority of the 2.2 million people who live in the Gaza Strip are refugees from other parts of Palestine. Their homes, their land, their water, and their rights are on the other side of this concentration camp that Israel built and calls the Gaza Strip. And so I believe this resolution will be the opening of the Gaza Strip, allowing people to return to their homes, and like I said, the dismantlement of the apartheid regime that exists today. The path for people of conscience who live outside of Palestine was paved when Palestinian civil society came up with a call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against the State of Israel in 2005. They provided all of us with a path. They provided all of us with a method of how we can help the Palestinians achieve and really help all of us do the right thing. And here in the United States, it's particularly important that people participate because our tax dollars are going directly to this genocide. They're going directly to the ethnic cleansing, and they're going directly to support the apartheid regime that has taken over Palestine and is terrorizing it. I'm fairly optimistic that this is going to take, it's going to happen much sooner than most people believe. I think we all must have hope and we all must engage. I don't think having being hopeless and not engaging is an option for especially people who are living, you know, rich, free, and alive all at the same time here in the United States or anywhere in the West, so we must engage. And if we all do engage, and when we all do engage, and I believe Palestine can and will be free once again, and Israelis and Palestinians will be able to live in peace in Palestine, in a free Palestine, without the racist laws and without the checkpoints and without the military presence, and so on and so forth. So in closing, I would invite everybody to embrace and endorse the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, and to do whatever they can to participate in this effort to free Palestine. Thank you.
Hi, thank you very much, Miko. And now we're going to go into Q&A mode. And so if someone would like to ask Miko a question, please push *6 and you'll get into the queue. Take a moment, let everyone do that.
Cheryl, maybe it's too late. I was just going to say there's two new people that have joined the call that we don't have identified.
Okay.
I don't know if we want to worry about that now, maybe not, but...
Maybe before Jason speaks, we can do that.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. Okay. Sure. So I don't know. We're in lecture mode. Is anyone? Oh, no one can hear me. I'm going to unmute everybody.
Well, they can hear you.
Okay. I'm sorry. So if you want to ask a question now, push *6, and you'll get on the queue. We'll just give it a minute here. Okay, so we've got quite a few people lined up here. We're going to start first. I think this is Sherry. You're coming
Hi.
In as anonymous. Yeah, go ahead.
This is Sherry. Hi. I have, two questions. I read that Netanyahu is being, prosecuted for crimes over there in Israel. It doesn't seem like, from what you said, that that's really happening. And number two, I was wondering if you know who Roger Water is, who produced Occupation of the American Mind. He's the leader of Pink Floyd. Do you know him? So I was wondering if you know him.
Miko,
are you there?
Miko's muted.
Unmute him. Okay. Sorry, go ahead. Okay, Miko, you're right, unmuted now.
So did you ask me if I know who Roger Waters is? Of course I know Roger Waters is. I'm a Pink Floyd fan. I was a Pink Floyd fan before I became a Palestine fan.
I know, but have you seen his Occupation of the American Mind?
Of course.
I think what should happen is that we should get together with Pink Floyd and Willie Nelson, who I happen to know that he's a truther, and his son, Lucas Nelson, who's hot right now, remember they did Farm Aid to do a fundraiser. So that was just a suggestion. Yeah. I think that Pink Floyd might be very open to doing that.
Yeah. Well, let me answer your question. You asked about Netanyahu's indictment.
Right.
Well, the corruption charges. So he was charged, and the Attorney General announced that. He is recommending that Netanyahu be indicted pending a hearing. So that means Netanyahu gets to, state his case and defend himself in a hearing first. The hearing is not going to take place until next year. Evidence won't be presented until the summer. The elections are in 2 weeks. Meanwhile, Netanyahu has given Israel recognition by the United States of Jerusalem as a capital city and the Golan Heights as part of Israel. He's a prime minister with incredible accomplishments. He's the smartest politician in the country, and he has more experience as a politician, more savvy than anybody, all the rest of them put together. So although, and now, you know, they just bombed Syria. They're saying that they bombed Iranian targets in Syria. They're bombing the hell out of Gaza. They just bombed the Palestinian prime minister's office, and they're very proud of that. So in other words, and he's has pictures of him with generals and wearing his, you know, his fancy military coat. And that's really all it takes. So all the corruption stuff is really minor to what is happening now, and it's going to have no effect whatsoever, I believe, in the election. Roger Waters is one of the biggest supporters of BDS, and he's the guy, every time some big name decides to, or is invited to perform to an Israeli audience, Roger Waters, the first thing that happens is they get a call from Roger Waters asking them to respect the call to boycott, and many do, not all, but many, many do. And he's been a terrific, terrific ally to the BDS call, to Palestine in general, and for many, many years now. In fact, he had a tour, finished a tour, and in his, you know, in front of, I don't know, he had thousands that come to his concerts, he was wearing a keffiyeh, talking about Palestine, talking about BDS. So he's fearless, and it would be great if there were more people like him. That's the story of Roger Waters.
Okay. Thank you, Sherry, okay, for your question. Now we're going to Marie Spike. Sorry, we have a long list of people wanting to ask questions, so if you could keep it, you know, short and concise. Thank you to the questioners. Go ahead, Marie.
Yeah, sure. Yes, hi. Miko, please repeat the name of the organization those Palestinians were arrested, the organization of the Anti-Defamation League had said was a terrorist organization.
Oh,
and
the
your
Holy
book.
Land Foundation. The Holy Land Foundation.
It was the Holy Land Foundation?
Yeah, it was called the Holy Land Foundation, yes.
Okay,
and please... And the book is called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5, because these are five guys that were convicted.
Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land
Foundation 5.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're
thank
welcome.
You, Marie. Okay, next, Xander.
Hey, just a quick one, Miko. Thanks for being on the call. I'm curious, growing up in Jerusalem, were you apprised of things like the King David Hotel bombing in your education in the public school system there?
Marginally, yeah. We knew that these things happened. There's several things that we do learn about in 1948. The bombing we do learn about, and the Deir Yassin massacre. Those are two things that are taught, but they're not taught in great detail. They're just taught as, you know, oops, you know, we've done some things that may have been a little bit questionable. Both of these things were done by groups that were marginal, and although they probably were wrong, the end result was good for us, so it's not that big of a deal. That's kind of how these things are taught. So yeah, I knew about that. Now, I knew about these things also because my father was, you know, fought in 1948, and my family, you know, lived in Jerusalem. My mother was born in Jerusalem, and my family is the Jerusalemite family. So I knew about these things from home as well. You know, Deir Yassin is in Jerusalem, is a part of Jerusalem. It's still there. The village, the homes, they're still there. There are many survivors that live outside. But, of course, the King David Hotel. These are things that I grew up hearing people talk about at home. And, you know, the extended family, people were involved in these things and so on. So I probably learned more about these things at home than I did in school, although yeah, we did learn about these things, but not in great depth, and of course not in any way that makes us look bad.
Okay, thank you for your reply. Thanks.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Xander. All right, Marty Hopper, you're next. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Marty Hopper in Colorado. Hi, Miko.
Hey.
I just wanted to say my husband and I just returned from a trip to Palestine 4 weeks ago, and it was a bearing witness trip. We stayed the whole time in Palestine, and I saw the scenes that you are describing, and one in particular, I chose to go through a checkpoint at 5:30 in the morning with male Palestinian workers who are just trying to get from their homes in Bethlehem to their jobs in Israel. So basically, walking across the street takes at least an hour if they're lucky and get through. And we're all funneled. We were all funneled into a cattle chute. We're just crammed in there. A lot of the men are trying to jump the line. They're climbing over tall fences and jumping down in with the rest of us. And then, you know, kind of herded into turnstiles. They only let four through at a time. Then you go through like an airport security, you know, x-rays, all that the stuff with your things that you're bringing. And it's just basically a totally humiliating experience, which I think is the purpose. And just to get to work. And so I don't have a question. I just wanted to thank you for speaking up and to have the courage, because what you are doing, my understanding, is very unpopular among Israelis. And I thank you for your courage to do that, and would like to encourage others listening, if you have the opportunity or to go on one of these really alternative tours, I would strongly recommend it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Sure, yeah. Okay. I'll just say that. Sure. Thanks for going, and thanks for what you said. It's the situation in checkpoints is absurd. You know, what's interesting is that there are thousands of the Palestinian day laborers who just jump the fence. It's a 30-foot wall because they can't get into the checkpoint. They don't have permits. And there are thousands each day that jump the 30-foot wall to go to work, and everybody knows this. And some of them have to spend the night on the other side of the wall just because they can't go back and forth all the time. And it's a terrible, terrible situation. Of course, it has nothing to do with has nothing to do with security. It has everything to do with humiliation.
Okay. Kat, you're next. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Miko, for being here. For the Holy Land Foundation 5 trial, it's my understanding that there was an anonymous witness who got to testify undercover. Nobody saw his face. I believe he was Israeli, if not IDF. Could you let us know if that really happened and to what extent it was the nail in the coffin for the five who were on trial? And do you know if that was the first time in history, I believe, in U.S. judicial history? Do you know if that made inroads and now they are continuing to use anonymous sources for these sorts of trials? Thank you.
There were two anonymous witnesses. One was from the Israeli military intelligence, and one was from the Israeli secret police, the Shabak. It was the first time in the history of the United States that a judge allowed expert testimony to be given by an anonymous witness. And it was very interesting, because when you read the transcripts and you see how the defense team questioned these guys, you could see that they knew nothing at all. And they testified in both trials, the first and the second trial. And of course, a lot of the evidence came from the government of Israel. There were thousands of documents that were confiscated by the Israeli military in offices all over, in Ramallah and other Palestinian cities, poorly translated into English. The defense had no access to them. But from time to time, they could see that their translations were wrong. It was chaos. But these two guys they saw their faces, but nobody could question them as to who they are and what they were. And basically, when the defense team cross-examined them, it was clear that they've never been to the thing was they were supposed to be experts on Hamas, and Hamas, you know, having been recognized by the U.S. as a terrorist organization in the mid-90s by Bill Clinton. And so they've never been to any of, so, and there was, and the, just to kind of broaden this picture a little bit, what they were actually accused of was that the money they sent to Palestine, they sent to relief organizations, local relief organizations, and these relief organizations were completely legitimate. They were vetted by the CIA, by the State Department, you know, everybody in, who deals with relief works with them. But in this particular case, they were said to be controlled by Hamas. And these two anonymous agents, anonymous expert witnesses, were supposed to testify that that is indeed the case. And when they were cross-examined by the defense team, it was clear that they'd never been to their offices. They don't know who their board members are. They've never seen, they don't know anything about how their operation works. They just know that it's Hamas because they know. And it was an absolutely absurd situation. The only place on earth that those local charity relief organizations, Palestinian organizations, are considered controlled by Hamas and somehow illegal was in that courtroom in Dallas, Texas. And that was the role of these guys. And yes, they testified. And then later on, the Israeli secret police, the Shabak, on their website, I found an article where they praised themselves to say that they were instrumental in putting these guys away and closing down the Holy Land Foundation. And I don't know if it happened since. I don't know if this is a precedent that is continuing to be used. But I do know that today, you know, it took about 10 years and two trials to get these guys convicted. Today, it is very easy to pick up a young Muslim, Somali or Palestinian or anyone, and throw them in jail for 30 years. And usually they're in solitary confinement. It's become much, much easier today to do all this.
Okay. Thank you, Kat. Okay, Barbara Honegger, you're next.
Hi, Barb, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello? Yeah, is it my turn?
Yes, it is, yes.
Oh, okay, thank you. I couldn't hear. Oh, well, thank you so much for everything that you've done. You are an inspiration to the whole world, especially because of your background. My first question is, would you be willing to share your email with Cheryl so that those of us who believe that we have information that can help can get to you? Would you be willing to do that?
Sure. What do you mean information that can help?
Well, I personally, it will take me some time to send you the email. I'm just hoping that those of us who are serious about helping will be able to communicate with you.
Yeah, of course. No problem, of course.
Oh, okay. So my comment and question is this. Netanyahu, with the horrendous recognition of the Golan Heights, of Israeli sovereignty or, quote, authority, unquote, or control, whatever, over the Golan Heights.
Sovereignty.
Yes, well, some news reports say sovereignty, some say the other, but yes, let's say sovereignty. So when Trump did this horrendous act of recognizing Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights just the other day, he said, just for people who don't know, I'm sure you do, but for people on the call who don't know, Netanyahu said that what this means is that a state, meaning Israel in this case, that Israel and therefore any state, it sets a precedent, he claimed, can legitimately keep territory that has been seized by what Netanyahu referred to as a defensive war or a defensive military action. And what I want to make explicit here is that what this means for the future is that Israel desperately needs false flag attacks in order to justify continuing to expand its territory, especially for those who want to expand to the boundaries of greater Israel, which was one of the original goals. And or they need, of course, a real attack, but how it's very difficult to tease them apart these days. So when Netanyahu referred to, when Trump did this, Netanyahu called him like Truman. And I just want to make explicit for people that in World War II, there was Pearl Harbor, which we now know was not a surprise attack, and that Truman at the end of the war recognized Israel. That's why Netanyahu called Trump another Truman the other day. And the danger of this is that the 9/11 wars is the Third World War. So we had World War II, Pearl Harbor, Truman recognizing Israel. Then we had the Israeli centrality, the Zionist fifth column, Israeli centrality to the 9/11 inside job attacks. That is 9/11. That is the new Pearl Harbor, which they themselves called for it. And that is the 9/11 wars, which is World War III. And now we have Trump as the new Truman recognizing the Golan Heights. So I'm just I'm interested in your comment about the importance of understanding that this horrendous new claim by Netanyahu that if it's a defensive war, then you get to keep the territory.
Well, there's so many things that are flawed about this this entire thing that you kind of, it's hard to say where we're supposed to start. To begin with, it was not a defensive war. It was a war that Israel initiated, and throughout the 60s, leading up to 1967, Israel had bombed and attacked Syria many, 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 many times in an attempt to get them to start a war which would allow Israel to take the Golan Heights. Because really what Israel wanted was the Golan Heights from the very beginning.
Oh, I understand that. I fully understand that. It's just his claim that it's a defensive war. Yeah.
So he's lying on that as well, number one. Number two, you know, they can recognize any – I mean, Trump can recognize whatever sovereignty he wants for anyone anywhere else. It doesn't change the international law. It doesn't change the fact. Syria, I mean, the Golan Heights is Syrian territory. Doesn't matter what Trump says, what Netanyahu says, what anybody says, it's Syrian territory. Now, behind the scenes, there's talk of oil exploration in the Golan Heights, and apparently there's a company, and there's an article that just came out by Helena Cobbin in Mondo Weiss talking about this. There's an oil company in which several families that surround the president are heavily invested, and they are interested in exploring oil in the Golan Heights, which would be a terrible shame because it would ruin the environment. It's a beautiful place.
But by the president, you mean Netanyahu, not Trump, correct?
I'm sorry?
By the president, you're referring to Netanyahu and not Trump, correct?
No, I mean Trump. You say I was not a president.
Oh, you meant Trump? Okay.
Barbara, are you okay if we move on now? We're really behind
schedule. Fine. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Good. Okay, thanks. All right. And now, Mike Cook, you're up next.
Hey there. Am I on?
Hello.
Hello, Miko. Thank you so much for being here.
It's a little hard to hear you.
Can you hear me?
Not very well.
Can you hear me? Not very well. I'm sorry. Is that help? Hello,
no.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay.
Not very well. Go on. We'll figure it out. Go on.
Okay. I'm being muted. I'm shouting. I'm very interested in connecting the good people in the Jewish community, like Jewish Voices for Peace, with the good people in the Muslim community, like CAIR, CAIR. I've been to CAIR. I've been to mosques. They're very scared. They don't want to get on board with 9/11 truth. I was given a check for $500 to donate to Architects and Engineers, and then was later taken back once his wife got a hold of him, right? It's scary stuff, but we need to unite these good people. And so I'm interested in that. It could make a difference. Thank you.
Yeah, these organizations all work together. I mean, CAIR is a Muslim organization. It's not really a Palestine organization. The JVP is more Palestine, you know. But it's all these organizations do work together.
Excuse me. They need to be made aware of 9/11 truth. They need to be made aware of 9/11 truth. And the progress is being made with the grand jury, the special grand jury, and the FBI.
Okay, Mike, go ahead. Miko, did you want to comment?
I said these organizations do work together, so that collaboration is a very good one. It exists.
Okay, thank you.
They haven't said a word about 9/11 truth. They haven't said one word about 9/11 truth.
Mike, that's for another call, all right? I'm going to move on to the next caller now, questioner. The next person who's in line to ask a question is, there's no name here, but your phone number is 651-341-1965.
Dan Hennon, Dan, Minnesota.
Okay, go ahead, Dan.
Hi, Miko. Thanks for being on the call. Appreciate it. What is your thoughts on the recent QAnon drop relating to Israel?
On the recent what?
The QAnon drop back on March 10th, 2018, about taking out the deep state, where QAnon says the team, we are saving Israel for last. What is your thoughts on that?
I'm not familiar. I don't know. I'm not sure I know what you're talking about.
It's probably one of the biggest drops in the Q movement and the Donald Trump team as far as taking out the deep state. He specifically says we're saving Israel for last, and I would like your comments on that.
I don't know. I don't know what this is. I have no idea what you're referring to.
Wow. I would research that. That is very good news. Whatever's going to be done, they're saving Israel for last. So I think we can all look forward to that, because these moves and these announcements here by Trump, keep in mind, they're all optics. They're all being done on purpose to take out Netanyahu at the very end. So I would get really familiar with that movement, QAnon and Donald Trump. Thank you. Over.
Okay, so that's the last question. Miko, thank you very much for being on the call and answering questions. You are welcome to stay and listen to the rest of it, or I know you're very busy. If you need to go, that's fine too. We really do appreciate you coming on and taking the time to speak with us.
Sure. Thank you, everyone.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Okay, so before we move on to Jason, there is one phone number we need to get. It's 781-738-1848.
Oh, they're muted. Okay, hold on.
Oh, they're muted. Oh, okay.
We're still in Q&A mode. Maybe that's
Yeah,
why.
But you just unmuted him, right? For the person.
Yeah.
Who
are you?
David Rhodes from Massachusetts.
Oh, David. Okay. I'll type it in.
And we have one more Cheryl that doesn't have the phone number showing that joined about a half an hour ago. Who's that?
Okay.
Well, they're all muted, but unmute that person.
Can you hear me?
Okay.
It's Nita in New York City.
Oh, it's Nita. Okay, fantastic.
Okay. You're going to get that one, Craig?
I'll get that one, yeah.
Okay, great. Okay. So now we're going to move on to our next speaker. Let's see. Let me just see here. Okay. So I'm going to Okay. And Frank Telepko is going to introduce Jason. So let me just unmute Frank here. And I'm going to unmute Jason. And okay, Frank, you're good to go.
Okay. Cheryl asked me to put something together, and here it is. We are quickly approaching the 18th anniversary of the events of September 11, 2001. Essentially, a new generation of people are inhabiting the Earth that came of age in the wake of that game-changing atrocity. Three of the older generations do remember that day and its aftermath. Some of us who became advocates for truth were initially steered onto that path by the homegrown video Loose Change. Loose Change, in all three editions, was an international hit. It was authored by three college-age youngsters, the new generation of their day, Dylan Avery, Corey Rowe, and Jason Burmes. Each of these inquisitive and forthright researchers carried the early torch for truth. Tonight we have one of those torch carriers with us, Jason Burmes. After Loose Change, Jason went on to produce additional videos, including Fabled Enemies and Invisible Empire, both treating 9/11 and its aftermath. Jason continues his truth advocacy with video podcasts on InfoWarrior and We Are Change, in addition to appearing on other media outlets as a guest commentator. Most recently, Jason has been examining the release of purported, hidden until now, documentation that reveals, among other things, the tales about 9/11-related lawsuits involving Lucky Larry Silverstein's properties and possible U.S. military intervention and or interference with Flight 93 over Shanksville, Pennsylvania. The organization responsible for obtaining and partially releasing such documentation is Dark Overlord. In Jason's own words, the organization is a hacking, not hacktivist, outfit more interested in bitcoins than truth and are essentially extortionists. Be that as it may, information that they have already released, with the threat of releasing more unless properly compensated, contains some nuggets of interest that may prove useful in the quest for a fuller picture of September 11th. Let's go to Jason Burmes and his take on this development, a development that has been covered in the information security media, but not the mainstream media. Jason.
All right, thanks for that. So yeah, guys, if you are not familiar with these documents, I'm just going to give you a brief history of what they are and what I've been able to find in the first three layer drops. So on New Year's Eve, the Dark Overlord, this hacking group that seems to be international, their bigger claim to fame before this was they had hacked Netflix, gotten a season of Orange is the New Black, successfully extorted them, and Netflix worked with the FBI, and their deal is, look, if you work with law enforcement, we release it anyway. So after being paid, they released that. You know, they hack everything from plastic surgery to lawyer's office, and that's how we get to these documents. So anybody, you know, I've heard people talk about how they've had these since day one, and, you know, this is just a front, and they're not, you know, a hacker group looking for money. No, they're a hacker group looking for money. So they release all five layers in an encrypted file that you can get in Torrent. I think it was something like 78 to 90 gigabytes. I downloaded this, but beforehand, they released some sample documents where you could look at some interesting things. One of those that caught a lot of people's eye was that it had claimed that the military indeed did intervene with Flight 93. So to give you guys a bigger picture of what these are, and there are thousands of them, okay? I have now done probably about 6 or 7 videos on these. I'd suggest if you're interested in anything I talk about here today to go check them out. I think there's only one on the We Are Change page. Pulse Change, our backup channel, has 3 or 4 of them. And then you can go to Jason Justice 911, which is my personal page. And that has some recent stuff on James Woods, the Pakistani ISI. And what I found was very interesting in layer 3 of that documentation, the I wouldn't call it unredacted version of the first two chapters of the 9/11 Commission Report, but it was definitely the draft version that had been censored by the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, and various other agencies. As of now, I have not seen any other of the chapters in there, but we'll get to that in a minute. So in the first layer, it becomes pretty apparent that, you know, these lawyers are setting up a case that all of these private security companies absolutely knew that bin Laden was a threat. They'd all been warned, and their security was lax. In other words, you're going to see, for instance, a lot of different versions of the security equipment they were using to scan and what weapons were able to get through. And at one point, other than various blades and knives, there is a makeshift gun, which becomes even more interesting as you dig into these and you look at Flight 11. When I discuss, for instance, this quote-unquote semi-redacted or unredacted version of We Have Some Planes in the following chapter, they did dedicate a few paragraphs to the report that somebody had been shot on Flight 11 in the front of the plane. And we know this circulated pretty early on, but it made the draft report, whereas in the actual 9/11 Commission report, it's a mere footnote. Now, it seems like the lawyers are going after that angle. The Pakistani ISI, I suspect in layers 4 and 5, there's going to be a lot more. The Dark Overlord themselves, for instance, said that the information got juicier. Now, I don't know how they would have been able to go through all this testimony. We're getting transcripts of, testimony from just about everybody they could call, from people that worked at all of these separate airports, to people like James Woods that I talked about. He mentioned Larry Silverstein on the way in. Michael Levy, for instance, who was one of the heads of security there, gives an in-depth deposition where he talks about John O'Neill, his hiring, how he had been hired 33 days before this, Kroll, their role in security, and how Kroll had actually, I believe it was Kroll and O'Neill had written a report that the security was very lax. It went all the way to Silverstein. It went to the Port Authority. And that document, although acknowledged, perished on 9/11. So there is a lot of interesting things in here. When I talk about, for instance, James Woods, this is something I included in my 2008 film, Fabled Enemies, which was my follow-up to the Loose Change series, in that instead of focusing on the physical anomalies, I really wanted to show people how this worked and how it was an international intelligence operation. You had most of the hijackers coming through Saudi Arabia in what seemed to be a CIA front consulate. Michael Springman blew the whistle on that in the early 90s, was very vocal about it after the attacks. You had the Pakistani ISI, aside from, you know, Saudi financiers, but the Pakistani ISI directly funding ADA and others. And in layer three of this document, there are two files that I've been able to dig out that do pertain to the ISI, and they are fully aware of this funding mechanism. And they even talk about the head of the ISI. They don't name him as General Mahmoud Ahmed. However, I'm hoping he's, again, going to be in layers four and five, as meeting one of the hijackers in a hotel in D.C. 4 days before the attack. And we know that, again, Mahmoud Ahmed has breakfast with Porter Goss and Bob Graham on the morning of 9/11. These are the two guys that head up the initial investigation, the congressional investigation into 9/11. Goss goes on to be head of the CIA. We have to wait, just under 17 years for the 28 pages to be redacted, and not in full, by the way. So these documents are extremely important. When they talk about Woods, for instance, Woods had revealed that he was on a flight in the summer before 9/11, and that he felt like these four people on the plane were going to hijack the plane. He shared this information with both a stewardess and the pilot, and they filed reports. And again, if you're filing reports about possible hijackings and it's the pilot, how are these guys not on the radar? So we had no idea who these people were, what the circumstances were until now. And you can watch my in-depth analysis where I bring up the whole transcript, but I'm going to give you the rundown. So he was able to name two of the four hijackers by name when given photographs the day after 9/11. The FBI came to his home after he gave this report. And two of those people he named were Khalid al-Madar and Hamza al-Ghamdi, neither of which were on the plane which was being cased. And the plane that was being cased, according to Woods, was Flight 11 from Boston to LAX, the first plane that hits the World Trade Center that supposedly ADA is the head of. Now, he's not able to name, because it's in court, who he thought the other two were. He couldn't name them with certainty, so they're not even in the transcript. So you kind of have to speculate there. But when you talk about al-Madar and Hamza al-Ghamdi, you're talking about 175 and 77. And it really doesn't fit the narrative. Woods goes on to talk about not only the pilot and the stewardess interaction, but that he also interacted with Seymour Hersh later. And Hersh confirmed that the pilot's report was indeed made. So here you have more evidence that they were casing the exact planes prior, and, you know, that reports were being made on these guys. I liken this, for instance, to, if you've watched my film, that Diane Albrighton called the CIA on Waleed al-Sherry prior to these attacks, and nothing was done. We know that al-Madar himself lived with and rented from an FBI informant. So, you know, I'm just trying to get as much help on these documents as I possibly can, guys. I got to be honest. There are tens of thousands of them. Getting them into a database is awful tough because there are so many attachments in a lot of these emails. We're talking, a lot of PDFs, emails, Word documents, scans, just a ton of stuff to go through. And like I said, there's no possible way that the Dark Overlord could have scanned all these and said, you know, we're not going to release this because it's too juicy. There's got to be even more gold in there if a guy like me can find this stuff. So with that being said, I think I've rambled enough. Again, if you want to check the in-depth stuff I've done out, it's youtube.com/LukeWeAreChange, which is our Pulse Change channel. And over at JasonJustice911, that's also on YouTube. If you type in the Dark Overlord in my name, you'll find these videos. And like I said, I've done a bunch of them. So I guess I'll take some questions.
Okay, thanks, Jason. Okay, so if you'd like to ask a question, again, star 6. And Jason, could you give your website again while we're waiting for people to... Was it Justice? Jason Justice, did you say? Oh, wait, I think you're muted. Just hang on. I will unmute you.
Okay, that's my YouTube page. So it's youtube.com/JasonJustice911. That's just a personal one that I go on when I can. But we're doing 4 videos a day between the Pulse Change and the We Are Change channel. So right now we're focusing full and hard on YouTube because it's the best avenue to reach people.
Okay. All right, thanks. Okay. All right, so I think we have some people here ready. Sherry, you're first. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you please explain again who the Dark Overlord is? Like, what's his name?
So it's not a person. Yes, so it's not a person. Again, this is a hacking group probably out of Europe, maybe Eastern Europe. Who knows? Obviously, they're using VPNs. Recently, they've tried to recruit others. But as I've said, these are people that are looking for money. If they really cared, they basically encrypted all these files. And we did get 2 encryption keys from them as different tiers of Bitcoin were met. But the 3rd tier of Bitcoin was never met. So it's kind of a mystery how this 3rd key, if you will, broke out. Vice Motherboard was the one to report on it a day before I could find the key anywhere, and a lot of other people could find the key anywhere. I'm not sure we'll ever get the next 2 keys, which would be extremely disappointing. But yeah, this is not a hacktivist group. This is a group that literally are extortionists, and they've been banned on just about every platform. They've tried to raise money from Steemit to Twitter to Busy.org to Pastebin. They try to take their stuff down. So if you want to read up on the Dark Overlord, you know, just throw them into a Google search and get a bit better idea of what they've been doing.
Okay, thank you. All right, Xander, you're next. Go ahead.
Hey, Jason. Xander Arena here, man. Really appreciate your work that you're still doing on YouTube. I got, I guess, 3 questions. One is it possible that Dark Overlord has somehow been shut down and that's why we haven't, you know, that they've been apprehended or broken up or whatever, and that's why we haven't gotten any of the additional tiers released? Well, I guess you'd mentioned the Bitcoin, but I guess that was a notion I had. The other thing is, I guess it's an idea and a question, and one is it possible to create like a public chart or SharePoint site or something where we can all kind of see like who's checking out which documents, who's reviewing which documents, or who's looked at which documents, in a sense kind of crowdsourcing that massive volume of data.
Sure.
And if you seem pretty familiar with it, would you be willing to maybe set something like that up?
Well, let me answer your first one. So as far as the Dark Overlord being shut down, I mean, anything's possible. I'll be honest. I check just about every day to see if there's another leak just so I can go through some more documents and see if there's anything important and hope that the mainstream media or anybody will report on these things. I have no idea, to be quite honest with you. I don't. My gut tells me that they haven't been shut down. They haven't been compromised. But in today's days of cyber espionage, God knows, man. Now, to your point on, you know, crowdsourcing this and getting them into a database, there are people that have basically, you know, put all the documents on Google Docs. There are people that have highlighted it, done videos like myself. I honestly think that that's going to be extremely difficult to do since, man, I probably haven't touched these documents. I'd have to look, but the last time I really dug into them, I did a Biden video, and that could be 2-3 weeks ago. Unfortunately, you know, if we had the fervor of, you know, the days of, you know, whether they were poisonous or not, but before social media, when, you know, the Let's Roll forums were out there and 9/11 blogger was out there, I suspect that people would have eaten through at least 90% of these documents right now. It's unfortunate. It's kind of a generational loss. I'd love to see somebody, you know, make that their pet project and go through. When I do these videos, I try to show them on screen so people can check out the numbers, or I can tell them, you know, how to search for them so that they can grab them out and where they can place them. One of the nice things about these documents is a lot of them are by date. Again, because they're in different layers, you know, each layer is going to be by date and things have been extracted. You know, one of the other things that was really worrisome to me is that they did ask people to privately contact them. So not only is the possibility that these guys have been busted, but there's also the possibility that they've sanitized them a little. You know, they know how to database things. So let's say that Joe Biden ends up in these documents because he was meeting with General Mahmoud Ahmed after the attacks, or somebody like, you know, Goss or Bob Graham wants to get their name out of there and they contact him. Who knows? I mean, anything is possible. I always tell people to have discernment and do what's probable. But, brother, hey, make it your pet project on a weekend. And who knows, maybe by the time Layer 4 leaks, we will have a database and a better understanding of this stuff. Because right now, I am just so sickened today with how the mainstream media treats this. I tried to watch that Vice movie a couple nights ago, and basically the opening scene that's cutting in with Dick Cheney being a drunk is him going into the PEOC on the morning of 9/11, and it's a total lie because they've got him in there after the Pentagon attack saying shoot things down, when everybody who has studied this knows he was in there at 9:23. Norman Mineta testified on several different occasions that he allowed that strike to occur, that the plane was 50 miles out and 20 miles out. Do the orders still stand? Well, that's not in the movie. I didn't mean to go on a rant here, brother, but it's tough out there. I appreciate the question.
Yeah. Hey.
Okay, great.
Sorry, guys, one more. I got an idea for a film. Can I contact you privately on it?
Sure. I have open DMs on my Twitter, man. I'll take a look for sure. Okay?
Cool. All right. Thanks, Mike.
You got it.
Okay. Dave, what, Mike Swinkle, you're next?
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes.
Hi, this is Dave Meiswinkle from the Lawyers Committee. Jason, we just filed the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, a major lawsuit on Monday under the Administrative Procedure Act. We have 7 counts to it. One of the areas of interest has to do with the financing. And you mentioned the ISI in Pakistan and that $100,000 wire.
Mm-hmm.
And myself and others in the Lawyers Committee were interested in trying to track that down or to verify it as best we could. And we were wondering if you are aware of any FBI material that they discussed or that you're aware of, because there's such material, there was a responsibility to assess it, and eventually, if it was not considered by the original 9/11 commission, which reading the report a few times, I saw no mention of it, although I may be in error, that should have been reported to Congress. Now, I think that's an important link there. And I've spoken to someone who is very knowledgeable in that area, and he could not confirm it one way or another. He said he was going to do further research. And you know, the synchronicity is here that you're on the phone and I have that question, and maybe you can be helpful in establishing some kind of link that, in fact, the FBI was aware of that financing that, as you referred to earlier, and that it involved the ISI chief, Mahmoud Hamad, or however you pronounce his name, and that money, I think, came from through a fellow named Saeed Sheikh to Mohammed Atta. Maybe you could just talk about that for a moment. And what do we have? I mean, from the beginning, I remember reading about that. Of course, I don't remember in what sources I read. And now I think we want to nail it down if there is a really reliable source, because you'll go forth into court and not really be able to substantiate what you're talking about, or you can get in a lot of trouble doing that.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, you're talking about the wire between General Mahmoud Ahmed that was transferred through Omar Saeed Sheikh, who was later tried for Daniel Pearl's murder, lost, and then was executed himself. Is there FBI documentation? I can't tell you whether or not there is FBI documentation. What I can tell you is that these lawyers fished out more than I know about, and you can get these lawyers' names that worked on these cases. Perhaps they have more of the documentation that they'd be able to share with you. However, what I can give you is that Biden, while he was a senator, we got him on camera twice admitting he knew about this, because he met with General Mahmoud Ahmed directly after 9/11. In fact, he's on national television talking about how General Mahmoud Ahmed and his meeting, he's meeting with the most powerful or the second most powerful man in Pakistan. So if you want to go check that out and check out his on the record statements, go check out my recent video. So you'll also be able to see the documents, so you can see the numbers. If you hit me with a DM, I'd be more than happy just to provide you with those PDF files. But watch the video, and you'll see that Biden himself on the record says, you know, this is true. He knows it. And this guy served as the vice president after this. You know, it's crazy to me that nobody has ever confronted, you know, they're still talking about him running for president. And he intricately helped cover up the financial aspects of 9/11 to the hijackers by working with this guy.
Is there a phone number we could reach you at? One of us?
I'll tell you what, if you, again, just get me at me on a DM on Twitter, and we'll talk that way, and for sure, I'll give you a number.
Okay, thank you very much.
You got it.
Okay, Kat, you're next. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Kat. Am I on?
Yes, yep. You are. Yep.
Yep, thank you. Okay. Hi, Jason. In The Dark Overlord, are you seeing any mentions of Israel or other Zionist involvement in 9/11? And part two of my question is, are you personally familiar with Oded Yanan, Clean Break, or Chris Berlin's work? What is your personal feeling about the role of Israel and Israeli First Zionists on 9/11?
So if anybody hasn't seen my film from 2008, there's an almost 20-minute section on, you know, at least the connections that were there at the time on Israel's role in 9/11. So, you know, I've used Fabled Enemies, that film, as a tool to kind of search through this in keywords. And I've looked through Amdocs, I've looked through Converse, Urban Moving Systems was another one, Israel, Israeli, you know, as far as bomb and explosive material, that comes up so frequently in these documents, it's very tough. You know, you're not finding anything, for instance, on the George Washington Bridge incident, nothing with the art students, at least so far. So I haven't seen that in there. However, you know, I always tell people that that role is absolutely in there, but I've always said this is an international intelligence operation. You know, just like we discussed the hijackers coming in from Saudi Arabia, some of the financing coming through the Pakistani ISI, it seemed that the Israeli government, at least the spy network, had compromised a ton of agencies and our telecommunication system. Then you look at how they actually rounded up a lot of these Israeli pre-9/11, post-9/11. Dershowitz gets them moved with the diplomatic immunity afterwards. Absolutely had a role. Again, if you watch my film, you'll see Ari Fleischer and Colin Powell commenting on it after 9/11. However, without the drills, in my opinion, in the United States, the ones that took place in Cheyenne Mountain, you just can't facilitate the attack. What these documents, at least to me, are showing are a lot more of the ground level planning and kind of the roles of ADA and the others and you know, what kind of evidence we're going to find. For instance, another thing that I've looked into in these documents I haven't found a peep about is Abel Danger. And I don't know, did the lawyers just not want to get into that? You know, Kurt Weldon, who was a congressman at the time, you know, got his weight behind it. So who knows what's in layers 4 and 5, but as of right now, I really haven't found anything on Israel.
Thank you.
You got it.
Okay, Barbara, you're next.
Hi, can you hear me? It's Barb.
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, good. Great. Thank you so much, Jason. You know, I'm not studied up on Dark Overlord, but you're making me want to be. So I want a couple of clarification questions. Okay, first, who are these two questions? I'm going to ask them together because they go together. Who do we understand these lawyers are whose documents, presumably there have been lawyers who've been studying 9/11. Are we talking about, do we believe or know that these are the lawyers that are doing the big lawsuit against the Saudis? Who are these lawyers? That's number one, we know.
All right, let's stop with the Saudis. So it's...
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
But you're talking about, so there's a wide range of attorneys. So for instance, Hiscox, that law firm, Lehman Brothers is involved. So a lot of these are lawyers that are for Silverstein. and Silverstein properties. I mean, there are just document upon document that have to do with World Trade Center 1, 2, 7, 6, the Port Authority, so much paperwork on the payouts, the percentages, the suits, the countersuits, the agreements. And then on the flip side of that, you do have lawsuits for people representing the victim's family members that seem to be separate. But because all these lawyers are in connection with one another and they're all in suits together, they're all consolidated. Man, I think the judge's name is Heller. Don't quote me on that. Maybe Heller or Hellerstein. But the main judge that's making these rulings, at least, is him, and he's in just about every single one of these filings I've seen. So this is just a massive data dump.
Okay, all right. So that explains an overview, anyway, of the lawyers. And then my big question, and as you know, Dave Meiswinkle and I are on the board of the Lawyers Committee, and we just filed this amazing lawsuit against the FBI and the Department of Justice on Monday, 2 days ago, in D.C. federal court. And this is all about the 9/11 Commission report and the 9/11 Review Commission report, what's in it and what isn't. So if I understood you correctly, can you say as much as you can now in summary to direct Dave and I and Mick Harrison, our litigation director, towards more information? I believe you said in layer 3 is the one place that you found, if I understood correctly, a censored chapter, an original chapter draft, if you will, of one of the chapters of the 9/11 Commission report that had, edits that are visible by CIA, NSA, et cetera. Is that correct? And can you please give Dave Meiswinkle, myself, and Mick Harrison, we're the major people working on this, the precise PDF for these, anything related to the 9/11 Commission report drafts?
No, 100% they are. If you go to, let me see if I can just bring up what document number it is right now. If you go to my video, it is called The Dark Overlord, Huge Revelations, only has 859 views. It's on my personal site.
What's it called? Couldn't hear you. What's it called?
Sure. It's called The Dark Overlord, Huge Revelations. And I believe I brought it up right here. So basically, in about 3 minutes, I show you what's in the actual 9/11 Commission report on the Flight 11. And then let's see where it is. Here it is, blacked out. So the document number, as I'm reading it right now to you, Barbara, so you can just fish it out once you have it decrypted, is 002-17308.pdf. And that'll get you the one that was subject to classification review with a lot of extra stuff, but still a lot of blackouts as well.
Okay, and when you say decrypted, I don't know how to do that. I'm technophobic, but what do you do?
I would say people already have it decrypted, so you're not going to have to download the torrent or anything like that. Just find somewhere that, you know, they're hosting this. And if not, just contact me on Twitter, and I will be happy to email it to you.
I don't do Twitter. Can you give us another way?
Sure. Just email me at jasonisvoid, V-O-I-D, at yahoo.com.
Okay. Thanks, Jason, so much.
You got it.
Okay. Thank you, Barbara. And now, David Rold, you're up next. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
This is David Rold. So my question is a little similar to Kat's. I'm a little confused by your talk. Are you saying that the 20 Arabs who are in the official story are the hijackers, that they really exist and that they really did hijack the planes and that they really did pilot passenger planes into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon? Because I think that story is just the cover story, and Americans or Israelis, captured the planes and landed them somewhere and flew drones into the towers and a missile into the Pentagon. And
especially, watching Loose Change and all these other things and the focus on the drills. But the bottom line is these guys absolutely existed on some level. And when you go into who they were, many of them trained at U.S. Bases. Some of the depositions I haven't been able to read are, not only from the flight schools, but the pilots that train them. I mean, there's so much to go through here. something happened on those flights. And it seems like, you know, for instance, if you do have patsies and they are on something like this, wouldn't you have them do a test run? Wouldn't you have them, you know, basically think that they're going through with this? Again, I can't tell you what happened on these things. I can tell you right now that there's a lot of audio planes, most of which has been revealed from these court cases prior.
Well,
so
I mean, even if they existed, that doesn't, they could still be the cover story. They might not have had anything to do with the actual 9/11 event. You know, it's just a cover story. And then I hear you like implicating the Pakistanis and Saudis, and I feel like, why are you trying to implicate like people who had nothing to do with 9/11, leaving out the Israeli role?
Let me stop you. They absolutely had something to do with funding these guys, and these guys absolutely did exist. And there are public records upon public records that they were being followed, that they had been reported to several agencies. And if we're blaming these people, and again, you have a guy like Woods who has no reason to lie, saying that he can name two of them chasing a plane that gets hijacked that morning, obviously something's going on. And once again, if you have these reports about them, someone's also protecting them. So, you know, the final chapters aren't written on 9/11, but to say, again, I don't know that I could be more clear for the past decade plus that I believe this to be an international intelligence op. You know, there's compartmentalization everywhere. These people did exist. They did have funding mechanisms. The drills did happen. Israel did have a role. And I think that people just have this narrow view that, you know, one group controls everything. One group controls the world. And it's just a ridiculous one. You know, I've been in this game now, geez, since 2005, and I obviously was doing a lot of research before then. I you know, since 9/11, I've really done a lot of research into government operations, geopolitics, 9/11 in particular, my friend. And I'm just saying that they don't have to be contradictory. You know, the hijackers don't not have to exist for something else to have gone on. So I thank you for the question, brother.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, David. Sherry, you have the last question. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Sherry in San Diego. And I have to just say kind of how I'm feeling after listening to all this. And I think that this source of this dark overlord, this is my feeling, just a gut feeling, is suspicious. I think I would not trust anything that comes from this because we don't know the source. Okay, and some of the things you're saying, like about the hijackers, I disagree, and I think a lot of people do. You know, I think a lot of them were found alive and well, and they had nothing to do with this. And so I just feel very uncomfortable about this whole dark overload stuff, and I would really tell everybody on this call to triangulate the information that you get from anywhere, and especially from a source of some hackers out for money, okay? We don't know if they are giving disinformation to us on purpose. You know, that's what they're good at, right? So I would just, this is a little bit sketchy to me. So that's all I have to say.
Well, let me just address that. First of all, you know, one of the first things I said when this story broke is, yeah, of course, be skeptical. I always tell people to be skeptical. Listen, you don't have to trust me. I would say go through my research. I'd also say go take a look at the documents for yourself. Anything is possible and plausible. I did a really in-depth interview with James Corbett kind of on that idea. But the more and more I look, I mean, I'm staring right now at this video where it's clear that we have a semi-unredacted draft chapter of the 9/11 Commission report that's never been available to the public, period. That's real. You know, whether they've snuck some disinfo in here or, again, taken out a name or worked with somebody else, it's absolutely possible. But as far as I know and I've seen, I got to tell you, and my research, this seems to be exactly what they said it was. Hacked lawyer documents that include sensitive, compartmentalized information from the government about 9/11.
Well, I don't know. I think it's sketchy, and I would not trust it. It doesn't feel good to me. My gut feeling is it smells fishy, so I don't understand it. I believe that the United States of America was taken over by Zionists in Israel on 9/11, hook, line, and sinker. They're at my church down here. They're across the nation. It's amazing. There are
okay,
there,
Sherry. Sherry.
So, you know, I'm sorry, but I just disagree. If it's not pointing to the real culprits, then something smells disinfo to me. I'll sign off. Thank you.
Okay, Sherry. Thank you. And Jason, I really want to thank you for all you've done. One of the reasons I asked you on to speak about it is because you're one of the few people really looking into it and putting out your videos. And I think if people watch your videos, they'll see that you're very balanced in your approach about this, and you're not being fooled by anything. So, again, I appreciate your work. Thank you for joining us, and you're welcome to stay on the call or not. It's up to you. And, again, thanks a lot.
Thank you guys for having me. I'll talk to you later.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. So let me just. Okay. So we're back into lecture mode, and we're going to hear now from the Lawyers Committee people who are on the call with us, which is Dave Meiswinkel and Barbara Honegger. And I'm not sure, did Nick join us? Let me get people unmuted here for a second.
We've got somebody unidentified with a 360 area code. Who would that be?
Who are you if you have a 360 area code?
That's me, Doug West. I was invited by Dave Cole.
Okay. Hi,
okay.
Doug.
Okay. Great.
All right. Just let me go. Dave Meiswinkel. Okay, so I think, Dave Meiswinkel, Barbara Honegger, you're unmuted, and if you would like to begin talking about what the Lawyers Committee just did, please get started, and thank you very much for being here.
Sure.
I'll let Dave start. He's our president.
Thank you very much. We were hoping Mick would be on, too, because he's a litigation director, and he was primarily responsible for the draft of the complaint that was just recently filed, but I'll give you a little background. And then we'll go into the complaint and the significance of the complaint. As you know, the Lawyers Committee filed a petition for a grand jury last year. We filed it on April 10th, and it was amended and again on July 30th. And we received a letter from the Southern District of New York, the U.S. Attorney Jeffrey Berman. And he said that they received the Lawyers Committee inquiry submissions of those two dates, and they will comply with the provision. It's 18 U.S.C. 3332 as they relate to the submissions. It has to do with the calling of a special grand jury. Since that time, we've written to them, and we were hoping to get some feedback from them just a little bit. We haven't. We've also, though, supplied them with a document having to do with persons of material information. Now, that's a petition, and the U.S. Attorney is, by law, obligated to acknowledge the law and do his duty, that is to do what we ask him to do, present this evidence to a grand jury. The evidence is 57 exhibits. A lot of it's the ground zero. Most of it, all of it, is about the explosive evidence, the pre-planted evidence of nanothermite, et cetera, and the bringing down of the buildings through explosions and bombs, controlled demolition, etc. So that's the evidence that's before the grand jury right now, and that's New York City, as you know, and that crime was multifaceted in different areas. So what the significance of this lawsuit now, it's under the Administrative Procedures Act and the Mandamus Act. What that basically says is there was a duty on the part of the FBI as a result of the 9/11 review commission that was formulated in 2014, and it was set up to eventually catch up for the last 10 years. And to the question then posed was the FBI had a responsibility to assess any evidence at that time and to basically present it to the 9/11 review commission so it could be presented to Congress that was not originally considered by the 9/11 commission. So that evidence now, at least in this complaint, is seven different areas. The first area, and fittingly so, is the World Trade Center evidence. And that's in the count one, And that sort of rehashes, or not necessarily rehashes, but is substantiated through all the material, all the evidence. It would take you hours to go through that's in the grand jury petition as exhibit. The second count has to do with the high fivers or the dancing Israelis. Now that was, and I'm sure all you guys know about it. It's the five individuals that were, it began with three in the early morning around 9 o'clock. They were seen by a woman in Union City who had binoculars and got their plate number and watched them as they set up on top of a moving van, and they were filming and photographing, and they were celebrating the crime as it went down in the beginning. And apparently around 9 o'clock, as we know, the first plane hit around 8:48. The second was around 9:03, sometime around that time. And eventually there was the all-points bulletin put out for them, and the East Rutherford police stopped them on Route 3, and they were backed up by the state police. They took a police dog through there, and it tested positive for explosive residue and on a blanket and a fabric. Now, we've since done some actions. We're trying to get a hold of also, we have documentation that the New Jersey State Police developed the film, which was confiscated, and they developed 76 8x10 photos, three sets, that were given to the FBI by the New Jersey State Police. So this evidence, we believe, was never assessed by the FBI, at least in publicly put into a report, never advised, Congress has never advised of it, 9/11 Review Commission wasn't, and certainly it was never considered by the original committee, at least to the extent that I know of, and I've not seen it in their original reports. In addition to that, there's a third count, and that has to do with the destruction of evidence, because just as this law was coming in as far as the obligation, as far as the FBI had as far as assessing this information that was not previously considered, we received indication that the photographs were destroyed, all right, around that time. Now, at least in the sense that the response we received was the request that had to do with the photographs, and the response had to do with documents that may be responsive to your request has been destroyed, all right? So it's possible that that those photographs, at least on one level, were destroyed. And we believe that the public has a right to know that, and certainly Congress should know that, and certainly the FBI should make an assessment. And those photos were never considered by the original FBI, by the original 9/11 commission. Then there's a having to do with the Saudi financing, and some of that actually was spoken of, but not in the sense of this new lawsuit, the civil suit, where all of a sudden now these three tranches of evidence, which I would think is a tranche of a voluminous amount of evidence, have all of a sudden appeared in a civil matter, civil trial, and we're sort of, in a sense, piggybacking onto it, and we have made that a count, that that's evidence that should have been assessed by the FBI. Apparently, they're in the process of declassifying some of it, and it should have been, the 9/11 Commission should have been advised of it, and Congress should have been updated on it. The fourth count is, and what this is starting to really get interesting, because as you know, the grand jury petition has to do more with ground zero evidence. That's was packaged by the lawyers committee, but the work was done over 10 years by scientists and architects involved with architects and engineers. So the work, a lot of work, really good work, was already done. And so it was a little bit easier to assemble it and to put it into the case, into the grand jury, and have a grand jury. Now, theoretically, you could have numerous grand juries going at one time. So what happens now is that the fifth count has to do with cameras. Well, we were able to locate or find out something that not many people know, is that there are a number of cameras inside and around the Pentagon that film was never looked at or assessed. And certainly the 9/11 Commission never got to see that or even knows about it. So that, who knows what's on that film, but what this suit is saying basically is that the FBI, it's not saying who did it. What we're saying is we're trying to gather evidence. Here's a right to know action, And we're saying basically you had a responsibility to assess the evidence and report on it. Okay, that's what it's about. So the next, and that gets interesting in the sense of this is photographs or film that's not been seen. And, of course, everybody that's involved in these committees here, at least our committees, these sort of committees, sort of like your group, is wondering what the heck happened to the Pentagon and what hit the Pentagon and what was the influence in the impact of a large Boeing plane, did it was it American Flight 77, etc. So we go another step further, and the sixth count has to do with plane parts. So as we know that a lot of plane parts have serial numbers on. They do have serial numbers on. And those serial numbers are indicative of the plane. So we want an assessment because we know that they have a list of that, or they gather the evidence, they gather the plane parts, whatever plane parts they are, and we want to know what the serial numbers are, because then we can start to match up the planes with the site. So if United Flight 93 is somewhere in Shanksville, well, then that list can tell us that, and it can tell us it's not there. And the same thing with Flight 77. If the plane parts for Flight 77 don't indicate that Flight 77 was there, well, then there's another theory to develop which wasn't developed at all. So this is information, or I'd even say information, it's evidence that was never presented to the original 9/11 commission. Then the seventh area there has to do, in our complaint, cell phone communications. As you know, at the beginning of the 9/11 commission, they talk about cell phones, and it's more or less like, oh, yeah, these things can happen easy. And we know as earlier on, David Ray Griffin did really good work on that, and he had some experts, and, of course, you couldn't make cell phones back then. Any more, I think, than above 8,000 feet, at 33,000 feet, you can't make cell phone communication. But then the Mount Sowy trial comes up in 2006, and now it's from cell phones to air phones. And then the famous report from Barbara Olson to her husband, the Solicitor General, Theodore Olson, claimed that he received four telephone calls of cell phone communications. Originally, that's our belief, or at least our research, that the FBI then said that she received no cell phone calls, and one didn't. It was registered as one as no seconds. Basically, there was an attempt, and they sort of flip everything from cell phones to air phones. So basically, we're saying, well, that's a big discrepancy. All of a sudden, history was flipped there in a sense, and. We want to see the FBI assessment of that information in a report form, and we want to see Congress get involved because Congress is a congressional mandate, and then we want the 9/11 Review Commission to be reconstituted and basically make that assessment on that information or that evidence and then relay it to Congress. So basically what this calls for, as I said, declaratory relief and injunctive relief, and an injunction is basically the judge says he agrees with us, and he says yes, you had an obligation to assess this evidence. You haven't done it. Do it, and orders them to do it. Orders them to comply with the law. So, in a sense, this accomplishes a lot of things that normally you wouldn't think you could accomplish with one lawsuit of this nature. But it covers a lot of the crime scenes from. The planes are all connected to all of them, all right? So now we get a confirmation maybe on what hit. Did the American Flight 11 hit the Building 1? Did the United 175 strike 175 strike Building 2? Did United Flight 93 crash in Pennsylvania? And did American Flight 77 hit the Pentagon? And there's evidence that would indicate what did hit it. And again, as I said, that would be plane parts, serial numbers in the plane parts. Let's see them, report on them, and then we'll go from there. So that's really a new thing, but it's not new to anybody probably on this call. You probably asked those questions yourself many, many times. Same thing with cell phones, same thing with cameras, same thing with financing, and same thing with the high fibers. Now the high fibers become front and center. We have the FBI reports. We know all about the high fibers. We know what sort of went down and what probably should have went down. But anyway, that assessment will have to be, if there has to be an evaluation by the FBI and presentation. At least that's our interpretation of the law. Then we have the destruction of evidence, and then the very strong, the pre-planted explosive evidence at ground zero. So that's a little bit, they sort of sum it up. But Barbara can amplify that. I just want to say that it's very important. It's very important that you have your groups like this. It churns things up and turns things over. That's why I asked that question having to do with the Pakistani financing with Jason there. That's something we would like to lock in if it can be locked in. We can't substantiate anything based on just our gut instinct. And we all have a gut instinct on things. You know, we probably pretty much, in a court of law, you can't do that. You'll get slapped down and you'll get fined. And they'll say it's a frivolous suit. So you have to really establish it. The best way to establish it is through the government's own papers, their own reports. That's why in reference to the high fibers, we have the declassified reports on that. So that makes it a little bit easier. So listen, our litigation director and the lawyer for the Lawyers Committee for Architects and Engineers and for Bob McIlvain and for Barbara Krakowski-Ristelli, both of them lost relatives in the 9/11. Mick Harrison is on the call, I understand, and Mick would be probably, I think Barbara would defer to Mick for a second, so you certainly should hear from Barbara, but I'd like to turn it over to Mick and let him fill in the rest. All right, thank you very much.
Okay. Mick, I think I just unmuted you if your phone number is 812-361-6220.
Yep, you sure did.
Okay, great. So go ahead.
Okay, well, Dave gave you some of the highlights. Let me give you a couple of the legal technicalities that Dave did not mention. The suit is brought under the Administrative Procedures Act and the Federal Mandamus Statute. As Dave said, the focus is to compel the FBI to perform the mandatory duty imposed on it by Congress in a 2014 law. That mandated that the Congress assess all evidence related to 9/11 not considered by the original 9/11 commission. So what we have to prove to win this case is not that any particular theory of 9/11 can be proven. We don't even have to prove that any particular subset of evidence is valid. What we have to prove is that the evidence that Dave just described for you is related to 9/11, which is obvious, that the FBI was aware of it, and we can prove that with FBI's own documents, that the original 9/11 commission did not consider this evidence, and you can see that from reading the original commission report, and that the new commission, which was 2015, did not assess these categories of evidence we're describing or report them to Congress, and that's apparent from reading the new commission's report. So we're cautiously optimistic that this is a winnable lawsuit and that the result will be that all this evidence will not only be shared with Congress and thereby with the public, but will be assessed by an independent commission, and that assessment will be shared, reported to Congress. So it puts, it moves the debate forward, because even if the FBI's reconstituted commission under a court order tries to whitewash this evidence, that whitewash is going to have to be reported to Congress along with the underlying evidence. And we feel like that's a major step forward, which also will give us then an opportunity to expose the whitewash. So I just want to give you those additional insights, and then maybe Barbara wants to add something.
Barbara, are you there? Let me just see. Looks like Barbara is no longer with us. Maybe.
Okay.
She's off the call. I don't know if she got cut off or what, but she's not here. So is there anything else you guys would like to add, or are you ready for Q&A? Or?
Well, let me add just one last point, and then maybe Dave has something before Q&A. But to state the obvious, for those who know how the law works, but maybe not obvious for those who don't. This FBI lawsuit will be public. Every step will be public. Every filing will be public. Any hearings will be public, as contrasted with the grand jury proceedings, which are secret as a matter of law. So anyone who wants to follow this can get on our website and sort of see the updates, or you can get on to PACER, the Public Access to Court Electronic Records site. If you don't have an account, you can create an account for free, and then you can basically read each of our filings as the case goes along.
Okay, and I see that Barbara has just joined us. Barbara, did you want to add anything?
Oh, yes, I would. I just lost my charge, so sorry. I had to charge my phone and come back on. Yeah,
okay.
I don't know if Mick is done. I want to make sure Mick is complete.
Yep, I'm done.
Oh, okay, great. All right, well, I would like to, because I was off for just a few minutes, I'm not sure if Mick covered this, I don't know, but the main point that I'd like to make is, why is this so important? Obviously, the grand jury, on November 7th, we received a letter from the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District of New York, a positive surprise that they would convene a special criminal grand jury. We, at this point, do not know if it's been convened. The upside is, they said yes, that they would comply with the law and convene the grand jury. The downside is grand juries are completely secret. So we don't know anything really about what's happening, and we might not. We hope to, but we might not. The good news is that this action that was filed Monday, the FBI, the lawsuit against the FBI and the Department of Justice for the 9/11 Review Commission action, is public. Unless the judge in the case seals the case, which I highly doubt, it should all be public, everything about it. And if we can get past an expected motion to dismiss by the government, by the defendant, which we expect to, and we should, based upon the strength and compelling strength, the dispositive strength of our evidence that's already in the complaint, if we can get through a motion to dismiss, we expect to win, and it should be public. So in my opinion, this is the strongest action that we have so far, but of course the grand jury action and this are complementary to each other. I would like to just make clear, and Nick or Dave can correct me if I'm not correct on this, but my clear understanding is that it's not just any evidence that can be in our complaint. We have to also, on information and belief, good faith information and belief, be able to either show or claim on good faith information and belief that we could present to the court if we get through the motion to dismiss and actually get into court with it. We have to be able to either show or claim on good faith information and belief that the evidence that's in the complaint was in the possession of the FBI, or the FBI had access to it, or not just that they should have, but that they did. So that reduces the universe of evidence that we can show either proof, and in a number of our counts, we can prove that the FBI knew. We can prove with documentation. In others, it's not as strong, but we wouldn't have had any of the counts in the complaint that we, as a board, agreed that we couldn't either prove or on good faith information and belief that the FBI had and either did not share with either the original 9/11 Commission or between the time of the publication of the report of the 9/11 Commission in the summer of 2004 and the publication of the 9/11 Review Commission a little bit less than 10 years later on March 25th of 2015. So that's an important distinction. It's not the whole universe of evidence that might be in the Dark Overlord papers. You know, we have to be able to show that the FBI had it or had access to it. So I think that's important. And the other exciting thing is just the honor of being able to work with this wonderful group of people. I mean, working with Dave and Mick on the complaint was one of the greatest greatest experiences and honors of my life, and I look forward to continuing. I'd also like people to know that David Cole is also on this call, and he is one of the other researchers, like myself, on the Lawyers Committee Board, and he's also on the call. I don't know if David would like to say anything. So thank you. Thank you very much, everybody, if you have any questions.
Okay, let me just see if I can unmute Dave. Dave, I think he's gone. I don't think he's...
He may have.
Yeah, I think he has not ready. Okay. So are we ready for Q&A mode, or did you guys have any more comments?
I had one more comment. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. It's just that as we go forward, we expect to do other things. And as I mentioned before, there's a number of crime scenes. New York City was done fairly well by the architects and engineers, at least what they did as far as their studies. So we could construct a grand jury petition that apparently, you know, it was good enough for the U.S. attorney to accept. As we go forward, there are other areas, like the Shanksville area and like the Pentagon. And we will be having committees, the Lawyers Committee will be setting up, and maybe some of the people on this call would like to have some insights. They have some insights they want to share, and is serious about real evidence that we can substantiate. So I put that out there. We have a website, lc4911.org, and we also have, for people that want to contact us and with information, etc., if you go to contacts, contacts at lc4911.org, you can leave a name, a telephone number, and whatever you want to say, or you want to direct us to something that we should know, you can leave that information there. Somebody will contact you and get back to you. Also, the Lawyers Committee and architects and engineers are doing a joint fundraiser. So this takes some money to see this through, just as it has did with the grand jury petition, and to continue to see it through, because we just started this organization, nonprofit organization, and anyone who wants to contribute, lc4for911.org. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. So now we're going to go into... If you'd like to ask a question, please click star 6. Okay, so we have a couple here. We're going to start first with Xander. Xander, you're okay? Go ahead.
Hello, everybody. This is Xander. Mick. And I have a question about, I read the submittal of the redacted names of those who may be of interest to the grand jury, and there was one class of witnesses that I noticed was absent, and that was the, one individual in particular, Zednik Bezant, the individual who wrote the explanation for the tower's collapses, which were mysteriously published the very next day in the engineering journal. And Bezant's explanation really defied reason, and it seems to implicate him in some manner, and I think that he might be of interest. So at any rate, is there any way to add additional classes of witnesses to the petition, or is that class of witnesses somebody or a group that you considered?
Oh, wait, hang on. I've got to unmute everybody here just second. Sorry about that. Okay. Okay, Barbara and Dave, you're unmuted, and I'm looking for Mick here. All right, Mick, here you are. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so you're all unmuted, yeah. Sorry.
Okay, so Xander, to answer your question, we did not explicitly consider that category in any detail, and so we didn't really decide to include it or exclude it. It's not too late to supplement the supplement to the petition. There are no deadlines as long as we don't hear that the grand jury inquiry is over. More information can be submitted, so I would encourage you or anyone else with information related either to the evidence that, you know, the crimes themselves were committed, as addressed in our petition, or evidence related to persons who may have material information, which is addressed in our supplement, I'd encourage you to send that to us, and, you know, we'll evaluate it and then include it in our next supplement. And, by the way, we're not encouraging the entire world to send stuff to the U.S. attorney, but it is a free country, and if you develop something that you think is relevant to this inquiry, there's nothing to keep you from sending it directly to that U.S. attorney in New York and asking for it to be included in the grand jury inquiry.
Excellent. Thank you, Mick.
Well, I would. This is Barb. Mick, could you clarify? I think we would prefer for it to be sent to the lawyers' committee so that we could screen it. Isn't that correct?
Well, yes and no. First of all, I don't think we want to restrict anyone's communications with the government. It's a First Amendment right. But we're happy to evaluate evidence that is sent to us. We encourage it to be sent to us. But it's possible that, you know, for some topics or some pieces of evidence, we might not consider that the information sort of passes our threshold criteria for submitting it. But the person sharing it with us might disagree. At that point, you know, they would have to submit it themselves or it wouldn't be submitted. So I think it's a judgment call, but, you know, we're certainly happy to receive it.
Right. So I just want everybody to know the word that Mick used was that we encourage you to come to the lawyers' committee. I would like to mention one thing. I don't believe that Dave mentioned it about our joint fundraising drive. It's a new joint fundraising drive, an official partnership again with Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. This new fundraising drive to raise funds for the FBI lawsuit only goes through April 15th. So it's not open-ended like the other one, not quite the same. And the reason for that is that Architects and Engineers hopes and expects to have the Holsey report that they're going to need to focus on in the public domain starting around then, sometime from mid to late April. So we put an end date of April 15th. So if you can donate, please donate generously any amount. You can donate to either website. It's obvious how to donate to the FBI complaint or the grand jury, and that is either through the Lawyers Committee website, lc4911.org, or the Architects and Engineers website. It's obviously obvious how to donate to either there as well. And the funds will go into the kitty for the Lawyers Committee FBI lawsuit. You can do that through the A&E website as well, which is ae911truth.org through April 15th.
Okay, great. Charles Ewing Smith, you're up next. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. This is Chuck Smith. Mick and Dave, thanks once again. You guys are just awesome. But I have an interesting sideline puzzle here. You know, I made a documentary called The Demolition of Truth, Psychologists Examine 9/11. And I posted it on 9/11 for free, the complete version on 9/11, this last 9/11. And I was watching my count, and it was going along, and I was only getting about up to 15,000 views after until the end of December. And then I think probably because of something about you guys, all of a sudden it started going viral, and I was getting 1,000 views a day. And in less than a month, I went from 15,000 to 75,000. Well, YouTube posted a blog, and the blog says, we'll continue that work this year, including taking a closer look at how we can reduce the spread of content that comes close to but doesn't quite cross the line of violating, in blue, community guidelines. To that end, we'll begin reducing recommendations of borderline content and content that could misinform users in harmful ways, such as videos promoting a phony miracle cure for a serious illness, claiming the Earth is flat, or making blatantly false claims about historic events like 9/11. Well, now instead of 800 to 1,000 hits a day, I'm getting 10.
Right, yeah. And that was actually put out on NPR National Radio as well. And many people don't know this, but believe it or not, when NPR published that very quote that you have that mentioned, you know, borderline 9/11 conspiracy theories as one of these categories, they're going to be cutting down on recommending other videos. So when you go to a YouTube and there are other videos in the thumbnails on the right in the vertical column, 9/11 videos are almost certainly not going to be in those further to watch recommended videos anymore. And believe it or not, on NPR, I happened to be listening live. This was maybe a month ago. I sent it to the 9/11 list, actually, when it happened. But believe it or not, they actually used a quote as an example of what was over the line for a 9/11 conspiracy theory. They actually used a clip of the voice of Neil Herrick.
Yay!
Yes. He's a solid, that's the one peer-reviewed article we've got.
Wow.
You know, the problem you mentioned, we're aware of that. Some years back, I don't know if you know it, they took Ed Asner's narration on Building 7, I think it was about 15 minutes, had like 1.5 million hits.
And yeah, I worked on that.
Yeah, okay, they took that down. You remember that then. And they allowed the lesser ones up with, you know, so many thousands or hundreds or whatever. But the main one that was taken down, and at the same time they were going after James Corbett and Luke Rodowski and others, and that's continued. And I would say that but for 9/11 and the war on terror, that would never get away with it. But we're not right now, as a lawyers committee, we're, you know, focused on the 9/11 issue. But certainly that has to be addressed sooner or later. That's really a censoring of the news there. And that's, it's what it is. It's censoring the news. And it's by an elite group of people that don't like the quest for truth. Now, I'm talking not as the lawyers committee right now is, but I'm talking that as myself, because we haven't taken a formal position on any of this stuff, you know, that we would be talking about. But that's a problem. We're aware of it, and eventually maybe we'll be able to somehow get involved in addressing it. It really needs a major lawsuit, I think, and really expose these people and this agenda here. But this agenda is what I'm saying. It's an agenda, and you know that. And when you talk about state, etc. So it's par for the course. We shouldn't be surprised. But we shouldn't necessarily just take it like it's nothing we can do about it. There is something we can do about it.
I sent their legal support a lengthy letter, and I haven't, of course, heard from them.
Yeah. So maybe Mick wants to comment on it, but I'm concerned about it. I'm really angry about it, and yet you get occupied with whatever you're dealing with, and you only have so much energy, you know, and only so much time in a day. And so
I'm just looking for some feedback, because I just feel alone on the subject.
Yeah, well, I don't think you're alone. I think that a lot of people in this group, I'm sure, are aware of that the news is being censored in that way, and it's really, you're a great example. From what you were saying, 15,000 hits down to a little dribble of a couple, 10 hits or something, whatever. That's amazing. Yeah. Maybe
look at my
charts
that they keep. It's just so obvious.
Yeah.
Well, Chuck, I don't recall seeing your letter forwarded to me, but feel free to email it directly to me.
The one that I sent their lawyers?
Yeah.
Okay, well, okay. No, I'm not a lawyer, so it's kind of personal, but yes, I'd love to send it to you.
Well, I mean, if you want our thoughts as lawyers on it, feel free, but you don't have to.
No, I mean, it's absolutely. I mean, it's probably more emotional than probably legalese, but nonetheless,
well, that's okay.
I cover the waterfront, so.
Well, it's an important.
I'll send it to you, Nick, and you can respond or not respond.
Well, yeah, that's fine, but I mean, this idea of censorship is related to what we're doing, and it may be one of the ways that our adversaries try to combat the effectiveness of what we're doing. So it's not irrelevant.
Well, it isn't irrelevant at all. As a matter of fact, on the letter that I sent to them, I refer to the work that you guys are done, and I accuse them of trying to censor something that is currently in front of the courts that has been legally accepted by the United States federal government, and that how could they, you know, basically take that position when it's in front of the courts?
Yeah.
I mean, it wouldn't get in front of the courts unless there was something there.
Well, good point. I will add just two quick notes. One is that Courthouse News did an article on our FBI suit filing yesterday or the day before, and it's no longer, I can't find it on the web anymore. It looks like it's been taken down, pretty quick work. another point, it's not the censorship per se, but it's part of the disinformation campaign that's equivalent. We haven't sued on this yet, but we're giving it some serious thought. The FBI is sending out information to local and state police, who are in turn sending it out to communities, encouraging them to help in the fight against terrorism. And one of their tips or strategies for that fight is to identify sleeper or potential sleeper terrorists, and they give certain guidelines for identifying who those people might be. And guess what category falls onto the list of potential sleeper terrorists? It would be those who are espousing a version of events of 9/11 that's contrary to the official story, basically. So
close the wagon.
Yeah, go ahead. So we got some work to do there.
Yeah, I'll say.
But that, at the same time, to realize that when you start doing that, you're starting to get desperate. That means that the heat is picking up. At least that's what my interpretation is. People are waking up, and they're trying to close it down. So actually, it's a good sign in a bad way, but it's going in the right direction. They are concerned about it. They're reacting and overreacting, and eventually that squeezes the energy out to different avenues, and eventually maybe it'll come back in their face. But all right.
By the way, this is Barb. That I do need to add this. It's important for people to know. I don't know if it was mentioned before when my phone lost its charge for a few minutes, but people should know that the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry and Architects and Engineers, in addition to Bob McElveen and hopefully other 9/11 family members, but the Lawyers Committee and Architects and Engineers are actually plaintiffs on the FBI, the lawsuit against the FBI and the Department of Justice to the Attorney General. So we are actual plaintiffs, and I just want people to know that, and Marty Hopper, I think, is still on this call. When I was invited to speak in Boulder and Denver a few years ago on a tour, speaking tour there on the Pentagon attack, when I was got up in the morning at Marty Hopper's house, and it was the morning of my presentation that evening in Boulder, Colorado, in the winter, snowing outside. When I got up and came out of the door in the basement level, she was at her desk, at her computer, and Marty said, "What's going on here?" And I said, "What is it?" And she could give more information, but the gist of it was where her normal name for her Wi-Fi name should have been, it said FBI Mobile Van. And I learned a wonderful thing about Marty Hopper that I should have suspected all along, because she's so courageous and a leader of the 9/11 Truth Movement there in Boulder and Denver in Colorado. But the moment I said that, I said, "Oh, that's probably because of me." And because it's happened before where I've gone to a city to speak. And she said, well, she raced up the stairs. She said, "Come on," and went up the stairs and raced out the front door. And sure enough, there was this white unmarked van just to the right of their house on the street. And I mean, Marty went racing out there to try to talk to the guy. And he sped away. And I do want to go on record here for people to know that we are being watched, and it's a good sign, actually. Right about the time, literally, that the Lawyers Committee, because I'm on the board, on the inside, like, you know, all the board members, where we're deliberating and deciding what to do in the near future, right about the time that we made a decision to go ahead with this lawsuit against the FBI, here in the woods in Carmel Valley, California, way out in the country in the woods up in the hills, I have Xfinity Comcast Wi-Fi. And right at that time, in the morning, we turn off our Wi-Fi at night. And in the morning, when I turn on my computer, my partner Danny turned on his computer for both of us, right where our Wi-Fi name should be, number two or number three down, where it always is, it said, it not only said FBI mobile van, it said FBI mobile van number 8. And it's still there.
Okay, so while this is a really interesting conversation, I'm really aware of the time, and there's other people who would like to ask questions, so is it all right if we move on?
Sure.
At this point? Okay, great. Okay, Bonnie Faulkner, you're up next. Go ahead.
This is Bonnie. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Okay. A couple of quick things. I understand you filed the lawsuit on Monday. What I want to know, number one, is what is the next step? And number two, what is this motion to dismiss? I don't understand.
Well, this is Mick. I can give you the short answer. The next step in the procedure in any federal case is for the defendant to answer the complaint, paragraph by paragraph, admitting or denying each allegation, or if they think there's a technical legal reason that the case should not be heard, then the defendant, in this case the federal government, can file a motion to dismiss on the narrow legal technicality if they can come up with one. I'm not sure what that would be in this case, but, you know, they always seem to try. So the first step is to get past that motion to dismiss, which is decided by the judge, assuming everything in our complaint is true. The judge would make that assumption and then decide whether, even assuming everything we allege is true, that we have, do we have no legal right to the remedy we seek. If the judge decides we have no legal right to the remedy, even though our allegations are true, the case would be dismissed. I think the chances in this case are pretty slim. We gave this some pretty careful thought before we drafted it. So after that motion to dismiss is overcome, denied by the judge, then the next step would be a summary judgment motion where you actually get into the evidence and whether we can prove what we have to prove to win the case. But, you know, we don't really have to prove anything particularly demanding in this case to win. Just that the evidence is 9/11 related, the FBI knew about it, and neither commission assessed it. So for that reason, we expect to win our own summary judgment motion, but the worst case to me is, if we don't, that we would actually get a public trial on the matter.
So you have to win a summary judgment to go to trial first, is that right?
Well, no. If we win summary judgment, the case is over and we get the order that we're seeking. Requiring the FBI to do the right thing. Now, if we don't win our own motion, but we defeat the government's motion, that's when it goes to trial.
I see. And so, but the next step would be for them to answer the filing. And how long do they have to do that? And that's the FBI, right?
It is. The government, unlike normal litigants have 21 days to answer. The government gets 60 days. So we expect to get their answer or their motion within that time.
2 months then. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Bonnie. Next, Ian Hendricks, you're up. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. For who?
Ian Hendricks.
Oh, hi. Okay. Hi. Thank you all on the committee for your remarkable work. I have two quick questions. First of all, could you identify the law or the legislation that created that mandate to have the FBI do a review of the commission? Do you have the specific law?
I do. I don't have it memorized, but I do have it on my computer. If you want to ask another question, I can give you the site in just a moment.
Sure. Okay. Did anyone reach the person who did the forensics on the cement at the Pentagon?
Could you speak up, Anne? I'm sorry. We couldn't hear.
Did anyone reach out to the person who I contacted who did the forensics, the lab study on the Pentagon concrete?
Maybe I can answer that. I know what you're talking about. It's in my Pentagon video on YouTube called Behind the Smoke Curtain. Are you asking if the Lawyers Committee has yet asked about that, has gotten to the company that did the so-called autopsy on the concrete on the columns in the Pentagon?
Yes, I gave the information to them lab and what lab did that. I gave that information
You give the information to?
To Dave.
Oh, David Cole.
Yeah.
Or Dave Meiswinkel. Who?
What's that now? I didn't hear that.
Did anyone reach out to Scott Walter, who did the lab testing on the Pentagon concrete? He also has photos.
Yeah, we'd have to ask David Cole. He would be up on that. I'm not up on that. What was his findings? Do you know?
Yes, I do know.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Yes, the findings were that the heat was way, way, way too hot to literally melt the concrete. And there was also strong evidence of iron. And that's in Behind the Smoke Curtain. I'll get you the gist of it. But to give you the big picture, Anne, answer to your question, the Lawyers Committee at some point in the future, not immediately, but at some point in the not-too-distant future, we will be addressing in depth the Pentagon evidence. We would like to try to get the Pentagon videos first as part of that before we would do a Pentagon grand jury a petition, just like we did the World Trade Center evidence petition in New York City to the U.S. attorney there. We do plan to do the Pentagon work, and definitely this evidence is in my work on the Pentagon, my findings on the Pentagon. It does need to be seriously looked at by the Lawyers Committee when we focus on the Pentagon evidence.
Sure, sounds good.
Thank you.
So, okay. And this is Mick. The public law that you were asking about that gave the mandate to the FBI from Congress is Public Law 113-6 and 113-76. These are basically appropriation bills that have some substantive content. That's where the mandate came from.
All right. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. And then Sherry Aspen, you have the last question. Go ahead. Sherry, are you still with us? Yes, I see you here.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, I had it muted. So this is Sherry. And so the thing that could happen, which would be the worst case scenario then, is if the judge said, no, I'm going to dismiss this dismiss this for some reason. And then you would have no recourse, or would you have recourse if that happened?
There is a right to appeal in that event to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. And if that court were to rule against us, the last resort would be the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, where Kavanaugh's sitting there, that 9/11 criminal. You said that the FBI, you had to prove that the FBI would have knowledge. Would a YouTube documentary that got published that somebody, you know, one of a good researcher put some on there, just by the virtue that it was on YouTube, shouldn't the FBI know that, and that could be evidence?
Conceivably, but we don't really have a shortage of evidence at the moment. We have actually two FBI documents that were provided to architects and engineers and then provided to us from supporters of architects and engineers And those two folks actually received correspondence from the FBI on FBI letterhead after they'd inquired about whether the FBI had looked at the demolition evidence and the work of architects and engineers. So we actually have confirmation that the FBI...
Okay.
So, and then if you think about the Pentagon videos, the FOIA request we did, actually Gene Laurentonda did, that we're supporting for the Pentagon videos, the response from the FBI, which said they had 13 CDs and 100 videos, they're the holders. The FBI is the holder, the possessor of those videos, if they acknowledge it. So that's not a problem. And we could sort of go down the list of high fivers. We have hundreds of pages of FBI reports on the high fivers. So I don't expect to have a proof problem in this case.
Thank you very much. You guys are wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. So I'm just going to unmute everybody now. I want to thank Mick Harrison and David Meisenkel, Barbara Honegger, and all of your cohorts there for all that you're doing. And thank you for coming on the call tonight in such short notice and waiting through the other speakers, et cetera. I really appreciate that. And now it's time in our agenda, and I know we've gone really late tonight. Anybody have any announcements they want to make?
Craig?
Yes, Craig, go ahead.
Yeah, just quickly relating to the workings of the call. Since we're not able to, in the future, continue posting recordings of the call on the Houston website, I've started moving posting on my own site a whole page that has all the minutes and recordings. I'm kind of working my way back, but in future, at least for the moment, we're going to put them there, and then if we perhaps in the future we're able to get a website, just for the teleconference, that would be great. That would be a perfect place to put everything, but since we needed sort of a short-term solution, we put them on my site, so you can actually see a menu on, if you go to my website, truthandshadows.com, you can see a thing for says teleconference among the menus, or you can go to truthandshadows.com/about, and that will get you there too, but that will be posted in the minutes. And also, since we're, there's just two of us now that are working on this, if anybody has this great ambition to do minutes of a conference call and would like to get involved that way or any other way, they can certainly let Cheryl and I know.
So yeah, please just email us and we'll, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, any other announcements?
Just thank you for taking this over, Craig and Cheryl.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, Barb.
This is David Rold. I have an announcement.
Yeah, Dave, go ahead.
So the NATO summit is next week in Washington, D.C., and it's the 70th anniversary of NATO, and there's going to be hopefully a large demo this Saturday starting at 1 o'clock at Lafayette Park up near, across from the White House and marching around, and there are also going to be a bunch of other anti-NATO conferences and demonstrations during the week from Sunday through Thursday. And the main website to find out about this is No2NATO2019, and it's the number 2, No2NATO2019.org.
Okay, thanks, David, for that. Anybody else have an announcement?
This is Bonnie. I just have a very quick comment. I wanted to just say, talk about the audio on the call, particularly with regard to the first speaker, Miko Peled. It was very difficult to hear him. It was the audio was so dim. I'm wondering, I don't know if he was on speaker or not, but when we have speakers, could somebody like maybe request that they pick up the receiver or something? It was very difficult for me to follow. Anyway, that's my comment.
So not to use speakerphone. Okay. Yep, we can do that. Okay. Any other announcements or comments?
Just to be pleased, the first speaker, is it Peled, P-E-L-E-D? He said that it would be okay to put his contact information in the minutes. So I would appreciate that.
Will do. Okay. Great. Anybody else? And I guess we can call it a night. It's been kind of a long one. So, but well worth going through and hearing everybody. And thank you again for everyone, what you're doing. And we'll see you next month.
What is next month? We usually at least hear that.
It's April 24th, and we have a guy named Dominic DiMaggio who's going to be talking about Shanksville. So that should be interesting. And then we have a couple people wanting to present that we haven't confirmed yet, and I think they were on the Pentagon. So we're looking at that still. And we actually have speakers for May already and one for June. So if anyone wants to present or wants to suggest someone present, you might want to do it right away to get in, you know, by June, or would you have to make it up until July? So.
Okay.
Good program. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Yeah, great speakers.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Good night.